Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I'm talking fear. Fear losing creativity. I'm talking fear. Fear missing out on you and me. I'm talking fear. Fear losing loyalty for pride, cause my DNA won't let me involve in the light of God. I'm talking fear. Fear that my humbleness is gone. I'm talking fear. Fear that love ain't living here no more. I'm talking fear. Fear that is wickedness or weakness. Fear. Whatever it is, both is distinctive. Fear. What happens on earth stays on earth, and I can't take these feelings with me, so hopefully they disperse within 14 tracks, carried out over wax, searching for resolutions until somebody get back. Fear. What happens on earth stays on earth, and I can't take these feelings with me, so hopefully they disperse within 14 tracks, carried out over wax, wondering if I'm living through fear or living through rap.
Having courage doesn't mean that you're fearless. It means that you overcome your fears. Our member station, WNYC, has been asking people to name their fears, and we're sharing some. Today we hear from Samin Nosrat. She's the Iranian-American food writer behind the influential book Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. And here are some of her fears.
That the color of my skin will bring harm upon me. I've always been aware of being different, but I wasn't really aware of any sort of threat to my physical person because of the way I look until September 2001. At that time, I used to wear this agate necklace, and it had the Arabic names of like the five main prophets of Islam on there. And so I remember I got a flat tire a few days later, and the guy who was changing my tire was black. And he was like, oh, what's on your necklace? And I told him, and he's like, you got to put that away. It's not safe to look like you look anymore. That no one will ever love me just as I am. There are a lot of etiquettes built into the way that Iranians relate to other people and other Iranians. And one of them is called taaruf. So to taaruf can mean something as simple as if somebody offers you a cup of tea and you want it, you must first say no. And you might actually want the tea, but you just have to appear to not want the tea. Like, I had to actually have my therapist go watch videos of it so he could understand me and my culture. But like, there's videos on YouTube of like Iranian parents training their kids. Like, here's a cookie. Do you want it? And the kid will be like, yes. And the parent's like, no, no, you have to say no. And so it's this really complicated like brainwashing that I'm trying to unravel. But it is still something that controls me and probably will control me, you know, until I die. That I will get cancer. I had a sister born with a kind of a brain tumor that children can't survive. So she passed away when she was 3 and I was a baby. And in a lot of ways, that loss has affected my family life. And I think my mom always was guided by like things that she heard or thought could cause cancer and kept those things away from us. So like we never had a microwave. So I think that that's always been a little bit there in the back of my mind. I'll never find love. Well, let's put it this way. My professional resume is much longer and more filled out than my personal one.
Food writer Samin Nosrat. And you can hear the rest of her fears and other episodes whenever you listen to podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts. 10 Things That Scare Me comes from WNYC Studios.
Is Tim still asleep? I think so.
He sure is one lazy nigger.
It's noon. Time to start the day. After checking her emails, social feeds, and blogs in bed, the millennial springs to life and makes a quick, organic, vegan, gluten-free breakfast acai bowl. She feeds on a diet consisting primarily of likes and instant gratification. After an arduous 3 months in the workforce, this millennial has discovered that adulting is just too hard. The struggle is real.
That is David Suzuki on the nature of the millennial, and that's from a parody of The Nature of Things, the CBC comedy video was made last year. Although meant to be funny, it does touch on how some people tend to view those born between the early 1980s and late 1990s as lazy, entitled, coddled. And now, according to a viral BuzzFeed article, we can add burnt out to that list. Published earlier this month, writer Anne Helen Peterson says millennials are getting a bad rap, but they're not lazy. They're burnt out. We'll be speaking with some of those burnouts in a few minutes. Well, we spoke with Micheline Lafleche, who is the Vice President for Strategy, Research and Policy at United Way Greater Toronto, about what Anne Helen Peterson calls errant paralysis.
The idea that your mind is so full of other issues that you're so tired from thinking about from the things you need to get at that you just can't get to your basic to-do list, that's real. Research shows that people really experience that. And this concept that you often hear that, oh, people are just being lazy and they don't put enough time and effort towards it. It's not true. These are real phenomena that are affecting people's psychological and therefore physical capabilities to be able to focus on the small things as well as try to worry about the big things that are affecting their lives.
Joining us now for their own takes on the tedium of tasks and this generational condition are three millennials. Shannon Pullis is a writer for Slate magazine. She's in our New York studio. Tiana Clark is a poet, author, and assistant professor in creative writing at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville, Illinois, and that's where we have reached her today. And Vass Bednar works in tech and public policy. She served as chair of the federal government's expert panel on youth employment between 2016 and 2017. And she joins me in our Toronto studio. Hi to all three of you.
Hi.
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 And Tiana Clark, when you first read Anne Helen Peterson's article, what were you thinking?
You know, when it popped up on my phone, I was really excited. I am also an elder millennial and I'm 34 years old. So not many articles are geared towards kind of that demographic. And so I felt like Anne had kind of put some language around the exhaustion I was feeling. However, when I was reading the article, I didn't really see myself reflected. So often the millennial conversation is centered on whiteness, when 43% of all American millennials are non-white. And there's certain consequences to not doing things on your to-do list, especially when they cost money. And I think as a POC millennial, not only am I dealing with the endless emails and the Slack notifications, but I'm still trying to prove my humanity inside and outside of the workplace. And that kind of has a different weight that I'm carrying. And I feel like that wasn't really discussed in the article. And for me, my response was to show what Black burnout feels like and that I don't feel like I'm even allowed to be tired.
So you're saying burnout doesn't feel the same. Part of that for you, you see it differently for racial lines. So explain that the point that you're just making, which is I'm not even allowed to or don't feel like I'm allowed to express or be burnt out as a Black person who is a millennial.
Absolutely. I mean, there's different stakes that we have to discuss. For example, if I'm wanting to set my boundaries in the workplace, so often I have to fight that stereotype of the angry Black woman or the aggressive Black woman or that I'm being difficult or a diva or demanding. So it can be very precarious for being a Black woman in an office or academic environment, trying to set your boundaries or to even express to your boss, or your coworkers, how burnout might manifest in your own life. When so often, and especially in America, there's a whole history of how Black women's narratives and Black women's pain has been erased. And when my article came out about Black burnout, so many Black women reached out to me and said that they were crying, that they felt seen, that they were actually so happy that someone kind of showed their lives. And I feel like that has to be brought to the forefront.
Okay, I wanted to ask you that because the three of you in some ways aren't the stereotype that many people have of millennials, mm-hmm. right? That you're living in your parents' basements and that you're just being lazy and you can't get work and all those things. So that's why I asked you that. But I want to go back to you, Tiana, because you, as you said, you penned this article. This is what Black burnout feels like. And you explained some of that and why you feel it's necessary to add to the burnout conversation. But I want you to think of your own burnout compared to what you saw with your mother do while you were growing up. Like, what do you think about when you compare yourself to your mom?
Yeah, I had a single mother. I come from a long line of single mothers and tired Black women, all the way back to my great-great-grandmother Freelove, who had 12 children and had a farm during the Depression to feed her kids. My mom worked two, sometimes three jobs. So she would work as an accountant during the day, change clothes in the car. She'd work at various restaurants to make sure that we didn't have to have any kind of government assistance. But that meant I was also alone as a child a lot. So even when I called my mom to tell her I was working on this article, she was like, whew, I've been tired my whole entire life.
And, you think you're burnt out? My whole life yeah. I've been tired. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that's, you know, that was the picture of what I saw of what being a strong woman is, always working. And I love my mom, and I think that was an amazing lesson that she has. But she also is straddled with so much debt. And so another part of kind of, you know, Anne's essay where she talks about not having college debt, but having graduate school debt. I think for a lot of Black millennials, I had college debt, and added with the other things. But also when we're paying off our student loans, we're also helping to pay our parents' bills. My mom is still not in a financially secure place. And like, you know, I think some for upper middle class millennials, they're thinking about maybe parents in terms of like long-term care in the future, but I'm taking care of my mom now because she's still not financially secure. And so I think that's an extra weight that Black burnout feels like, that kind of family load too, of having that shared responsibility of taking care of your parents when they haven't been able to take care of themselves.
Okay, I want to stick a bit with this worth aspect, and I want to play a little bit more from Micheline LaFleche, who is the Vice President for Strategy, Research and Policy at the United Way Greater Toronto, who we heard from earlier, and her talking about millennial employment. So here is what she had to say about some of the findings of a report from 2017, a United Way report into precarious employment. The report was about here in Southern Ontario.
37% of the workers that we surveyed reported being in work roles that had at least some degree of precarity. And that means that they didn't have these full-time permanent roles with benefits, basically. They had some kind of other employment form or work relationship to their employers. Including growing self-employment, especially among the young. So that really changes their experience of security and their ability to do lots of their life planning as a result.
Go and look it up and read. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
In other words, every Black person should know reading is more important than watching TV. And I say going reading a book is more important than holding something small in your hand and looking at it. Go to a book, go to the encyclopedia, and decide, let me go and read on that.
And now we're going to talk about race and racism in an area we don't often mention, in academic publishing. We're talking about it now because of a couple of incidents that happened about a week ago at an annual conference for classicists in San Diego. During a panel, Black American scholar Daniel Padilla Peralta challenged something about the idea of Western civilization. Another panel speaker, Mary Frances Williams, seemed to take offense, and during the course of a back and forth, she said that he only got his job because he was Black. A day before, two other scholars of color attending the conference said they were stopped by and questioned by hotel security for no reason. The two incidents are just small skirmishes in a larger conversation about lack of diversity in academia, and more specifically, academic journals. Academic journals play an essential role in our understanding of the world, even if indirectly, because most people don't read them. But with millions of articles submitted to about 30,000 journals every year, the industry only has the bandwidth to reward the most privileged of researchers and universities, who are, after all, mostly white and arguably represent a relatively narrow view of the world. And so while research should help defeat ill-conceived notions about race, critics say in many cases academic publishing can wind up reinforcing racist ideas. Joining me for this conversation about the lack of diversity in academic publishing and its impact are two scholars who are leading this conversation from their respective places. Dr. Alex Lichtenstein, editor of the AHR, the American Historical Review, one of the premier history journals. He wrote a piece last year called Decolonizing the AHR after his journal published a book review widely considered racially tone deaf. And also with us is Dr. Cristobal Salinas from Florida Atlantic University, professor and managing editor for the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in American Higher Education. So Dr. Lichtenstein and Dr. Salinas, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian. This is Alex.
Thanks, Brian.
Dr. Lichtenstein, can you tell us about the incident that inspired your letter and how that prompted you to begin dealing with race directly at your particular academic journal?
Well, it's complicated, but the short version is we ran a book review of, you know, we run 800 book reviews a year. We ran a book review of a new book on school integration, the history of school integration. And it was written by someone who in our database appeared as an ordinary scholar who had published some reputable books on this issue. But what we missed, or what the journal editorial team missed at the time, was that the guy who wrote this review, Raymond Walters, had morphed into, not to put too fine a point on it, a white supremacist. So the guy who wrote this review, Raymond Walters, had morphed into, not to put too fine a point on it, a white supremacist. Now, then the review itself contained what I would call dog whistles or code words, such as sociobiology. Then a number of we have a letters column. A number of scholars wrote into us saying, how could you publish this review? We concluded that they were right. We repudiated, though didn't retract, repudiated the review, wrote a number of editorials, but then realized that we had some work to do in terms of investigating the history and the future of our own editorial practices in order to make the journal more inclusive, more diverse, and more open to the kind of new scholarship that is emanating from groups all around the country.
Dr. Salinas, if there's a lack of diversity in the staff of academic journals and in the citations and in university faculty, how deep is the issue?
So, Brian, again, thank you for the invitation, but I cannot enter the conversation without speaking about my own experiences of privilege and oppression as a Latino and Mexican, because in these academic spaces, we talk about how it's inclusive, right? But oftentimes, this academic space becomes very exclusive among ourselves. And I can think about my own experiences of because of my accent, my skin color, and being Mexican, how people engage with me in those spaces, right? But also, it becomes a political game, and it is a and research has never been neutral, and it's also a political act when we publish and where we publish. So this is nothing new. This is something that scholars of color and also women of color been writing about for years. But it is it takes a while for someone to pick this up and say, we need to focus more on this. But again, we need more research on the lived experiences of students of color, faculty of color, and scholars that speak to the oppression and injustice that exists within our communities.
One particular issue that I read about that comes from public health researchers and other science researchers who want to study a specific issue in a particular racial or ethnic group, they sometimes don't get published or don't get the funding because the journals believe those sample sizes are too small when they're looking at particular groups in the population. Is that an issue, Dr. Salinas, that you're familiar with?
Well, you know, I think about the as a founding editor of the Journal Committee to Social Change on Race and Race and Ethnicity, published by the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity. So it's a new journal, open access, again, because when we think about journals, who has access to them? It's usually only academics, those that have access to a university library. So we interviewed a survey of members of the conference, and all of them said, especially those that publish academics, that they struggle publishing their research because a lot of these journals do not publish work on race and ethnicity. So they continue to be rejected, not necessarily about the number, how many they interviewed, but most the conversation goes back to it is because it's on race and ethnicity, not about the numbers that they have access to in the data collection.
Right. So before we go back to Dr. Lichtenstein, you're talking about the need for academic journals, including one open source one that you're involved with, dedicated to race and ethnic studies, I think particularly in your field of higher education, right?
Yes, correct, higher education.
And so, Dr. Lichtenstein, you, we'll talk about you how your journal is newly engaged in this issue over the last year since you published Decolonizing AHR.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should say, first of all, it's newly engaged in some areas, and in others it's not, in that this has been the practice for a long time. This is a journal that publishes all history, all time periods, all areas. So there's always been articles on race and ethnicity. But I use the term decolonizing very deliberately and provocatively to say this isn't just a question of inclusion. But I think, as Dr. Salinas is suggesting, that by being more inclusive, you also have to change the nature of the conversation, right? You have to change the shape of the space in which this conversation is occurring, rather than saying to excluded populations, come join us, but on our existing terms. Mm-hmm. No, you have to meet them halfway and say, and we are also going to change the nature of our review process, of what is considered scholarship, of our reputation as being a gatekeeper, rather than a place in which scholarship is going to be nurtured and brought forward into a larger conversation. So it's not just changing who publishes in the journal. There's a lot of work to be done on that. It's not just changing what is published in the journal. I think we've done okay on that in the past. But it's really changing the idea of what is scholarship as it appears in a scholarly journal. And the steps I'm taking are efforts to not explode that, but to throw it into question and open it up to new voices.
Dr. Lichtenstein, to follow up on what you were just saying, is it like people tend to react, let's say well-meaning people who are mostly white in academia react when blatant racism is in front of their eyes, but not as many see a kind of colorblind racism, if you want to call it that, the structural and invisible ways that lack of diversity shapes research outcomes and conclusions?
Yeah. I mean, in the case of the American Historical Review, I'm not sure if it's research outcomes and conclusions, but just a sense when I go to the national conference that the AHR is a space that is, you know, reserved for the privileged. And that can mean the privileged by rank, the privileged by institution, and, of course, the privileged by race, ethnicity, class, gender, and sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and that's a reputation that is rooted in a very real history of exclusion going back to the foundations of the historical profession for decades and decades. It was all white, all male, Protestant, I would add. Jews had to break into it. But it's the profession itself has changed very dramatically over the past 20, 25 years, become much more equitable in terms of gender, at least in terms of faculty, getting better on race and ethnicity and sexuality. But I'm not always convinced that that professional demographic change is sufficiently reflected in the pages of the journal. And mm-hmm. So the goal is to simply try and invite new voices in so that more and more people who are coming into the profession can say, well, actually, this is a space for us. This is an inviting space for us. And that requires breaking down barriers of perception on the side of those who feel excluded. And yes, it requires breaking down the sort of reflexive white liberal move, which is to say, yes, but what about standards? And that's the phrase mm-hmm. I hate and try mm-hmm. to avoid at all costs.
Dr. Salinas, do you want to just pick up on that?
Yeah, so I think about a lot of things, right? And one of those things that scholars have argued in higher education, again, how the graduate experience has been socialized by white faculty members, advisors, and staff, right? And they're nominating this socialization process in education. But also, Sandra Stiers stated that it's not only about who is white based on identity and skin color, but it's also about whiteness and how whiteness is perpetuated and maintained through networks and relationships of power and privilege within across societies and in this conversation within publishing, right? So a lot of editors have the power, right? Because and who are in these editorial boards are mostly white people. Mm-hmm. Are critical and conscious and are working strategically to create opportunities to showcase the diverse perspectives of academics. But also, decolonizing requires a critical consciousness about realities of oppression and the and social inequalities for minority people.
What do you think, Dr. Salinas, the real world effects of everything the two of you have been talking about here so far are? A lot of listeners could be hearing this and thinking, well, okay, this is all about things that take place in, you know, the rarefied air of academic journals. Does who in the rest of the world gets hurt by this?
Yeah. So I think that's an excellent question. One of the things that I have to acknowledge again is my privilege. Now that I am a faculty with a PhD, and when I write, in a sense, I'm making sense of the lived experiences of people, right? But I see my job as an academic scholar to tell the story of those unheard voices, those that have been marginalized historically and continue to be marginalized, right? So I'm going to bring it up to the perspective of a scholarship. 74% of the scholarship across the world, not only in the United States, but across the world, is published in English, right? Mm-hmm. So when we think about how is my research making an impact to my community, in my case, a Spanish-speaking community, when I think about my parents not being able to understand what I write about, so what I attempt to do in my scholarship is to write in Spanish, right? Because we need to publish in various languages as a form of liberation and to provide context and document the stories in history for our non-English speakers communities as well. Because if you get a PhD or a doctorate degree from a Spanish-speaking, for most Spanish-speaking countries and some other countries outside of the United States, in order to earn your doctoral degree, you have to publish 3 peer-reviewed manuscripts, and on top of that, of writing your dissertation in your native language. So I think the challenge is how do we also remove ourselves from, or how do we create scholarship for our community? And also creating more academic journals with open access to, so these people have access to what we're writing in their language.
So Dr. Lichtenstein, you said before that it's not just the diversity that needs to change, it's the scholarship itself. Do you think research methods in the social sciences or anything else that results in the publication of what looks like scientific studies are dealing with a lot of bias, and research methods themselves need to change?
Well, that's a tough one from the perspective of a historian. So, I mean, one could certainly say that, yes, you need to listen to other voices. So you need to do a lot of oral history if you're doing contemporary history, or if you're reading colonial archives, you need to read them against the grain to get the perspective of the subaltern. But the profession has been talking about this for a long time. So I don't think that's the big issue. I mean, what Dr. Salinas was saying to your last question is really key. I mean, you began by saying, well, you know, these have limited readership. And I'll grant you, I mean, look, I edit an academic journal. As academic journals go, it has a pretty wide ambit. I think 13,000 people get it. It's widely read, blah, blah, blah. But still, it's ring-fenced within a rarefied, privileged world of academia. And those are the people who are going to read and speak about what's in there. That said, the public face of the AHR puts the imprimatur on certain kinds of research, certain topics, certain themes, certain questions, and says with a big, bold sign, this is what counts as historical scholarship today. And that can be changed. And by changing that, it then eventually will filter down, and it gives the historical profession – this is a professional journal. I have no shame in that – a different kind of face and a different kind of voice. And I should add, I mean, we're the Journal of the American Historical Association, which is the professional association, and the AHA is also attempting to rethink what the nature of the organization is in terms of diversity, inclusion, equity, beyond just the university faculty room or the library or the privileged access to the journal, but what it means to be a historian. Sometimes that shifts research techniques, but we're not a social science in the same way that sociology mm-hmm. might be.
Mr. Trump, one of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only Rosie O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account.
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't frankly have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time either.
Republican Congressman Steve King has been a fixture in Iowa politics for nearly two decades, but he has come under new scrutiny after he questioned in an interview last week why the term white nationalism is offensive. Just this afternoon, the Des Moines Register's editorial board called on King to resign. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins reports now on how the Republican Party is distancing itself from a representative with a long history of controversial comments.
Open up questions. Let's take it.
This morning at a House Republican news conference, the questions were mostly about leader Kevin McCarthy's decision to strip committee membership from 16-year Congressman Steve King.
We believe the base of our country is fundamentally different than what he talks of.
The rebuke comes after King told the New York Times as part of a lengthy interview last week, quote, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? On the House floor Friday, King said his thoughts were misrepresented and cherry-picked.
Today, the New York Times is suggesting that I'm an advocate for white nationalism and white supremacy. I want to make one thing abundantly clear. I reject those labels and the evil ideology that they define.
But Republicans were not swayed. Today, GOP conference chairwoman Liz Cheney said King should not just be penalized, he should go.
His language questioning whether or not the notion of white supremacy is offensive is absolutely abhorrent. It's racist. We do not support it or agree with it. And as I said, I think he should find another line of work.
This after nearly two decades of controversy from King, with a history of comments that critics see as anti-immigrant, anti-minority, and anti-Muslim. Just one example, in 2013, the congressman argued undocumented immigrants were, quote, undermining American culture.
For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that they weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert.
But Republican presidential hopefuls have long sought King's endorsement. In October, President Trump showed his support.
Now we're thrilled to be joined tonight by a number of terrific Republican leaders, Iowa Congressman Steve King.
Who? Yesterday, he refused to weigh in on King's latest headline.
I haven't been following it. I really haven't been following it.
Last night, however, Majority Leader McCarthy clearly was paying attention and said King has shown a pattern.
These are not the first time we've heard these comments. That is not the party of Lincoln, and it's definitely not America. All people are created equal in America, and we want to take a very strong stance.
For more on the fallout over the controversial congressman, we are joined by O.K. Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa, and Asma Khalid, who covers the intersection of politics and demographics for NPR. Kay, I want to start with you. Tell us, how do voters and politicians see King's remarks and also the actions against him by Republicans?
This is a split decision among Republicans. There are Republicans among the conservative base that very much think Steve King is being thrown under the bus. Those were the words that were used by the former Republican National Committee woman from Iowa on Twitter this morning, whereas there are other Republicans who have sort of run out of patience. One, in the word of one, they're just weary of defending Congressman King. The reason this has sort of risen to the fore is because he did not perform as well as expected in the 2018 election. And looking forward to 2020, Republicans here on the ground are worried about their prospects if he is on the ballot.
Asma, of course, late today, the House of Representatives passed a resolution that recognized or talked about Steve King's comments and then condemned white supremacy and also white nationalism, though didn't specifically condemn him. My question to you is, these are not the first controversial remarks he's made, not even the first controversial remarks about the phrase white supremacy. Why politically do you think this is happening now?
I mean, I think that Kay is correct in sort of pointing out the political reality on the ground there in the district in Iowa that's made this rise up. But I also think that to some degree there are Republicans within the party that are increasingly frustrated with the tone that their party standard bearer, Donald Trump, has taken. And they can't necessarily continuously call him out on things, nor do they sort of feel like that's a politically expedient thing to do. And so it's easier to sort of publicly rebuke and reprimand a sitting congressman.
It's interesting. Kay, when I've been reporting in Iowa covering politics, I've found that Iowa voters really value tolerance. This is something that they've conveyed to me. Yet here we have Steve King, someone who's in the past said he questions multiculturalism. He's not even sure that mixing cultures is a good idea. Why is it that voters keep electing him? What do they see in him?
I talked to a well-known conservative in the district today, and the word they used was loyalty. Steve King has been loyal to them and to the district, and they feel in return they should be loyal to him. In the past, when Steve King has been rebuked, as he was in 2013 by then House Speaker John Boehner for comments that King made about the so-called Dreamers, residents in that district rose up and defended him. I think one of the things that Steve King has said that may be resonating with his base in that district is that this is an attack on him by the establishment of the party. And back to my first point, when you look at that district, Donald Trump won that district by 27 points in the 2016 election. So there is a large swath of voters in there who are anti-establishment, and so that is going to resonate with them.
Asma, let's take a bigger view. How is the Republican Party generally dealing with race right now? Is this a sea change today? Is it something less? What is this? Where are they?
I think that's an excellent question, and I don't know what the answer is entirely, in part because if we look at the party's standard bearer, it's Donald Trump. And you know, Kay was talking about how well he did in Steve King's district. I mean, a lot of the sort of quantitative analysis that we've seen since the 2016 election really does show that a number of people who were President Obama supporters who then became Donald Trump supporters did switch because of identity politics or race-based issues. And this is not, you know, me just talking sort of off the cuff on anecdotal interviews I've done. We have political science researchers, most notably John Sides and Michael Tesler, who've looked at this really analytically and have found that a number of people, sort of one of the most consistent reasons we saw this shift was largely because of people who identified with what we call a white grievance, right? This idea that folks feel that white people have it worse than anybody else in society. And so when you have the leader of the Republican Party, as it is in the form of Donald Trump right now, who's really capitalized on that sentiment, I think it's really hard to assess what's happening below, whether it's in the form of Congress or even at a local Republican club member, that's different because what we're hearing from the president doesn't necessarily support the idea of a sea change.
Asma, let me just stay and finish with you and talk about the stakes here. I'm curious, we seem to have one party that believes racism is a core and significant problem in our society. We have another party that believes that is exaggerated and that racism is being used as a political foil. What are the risks of that divide? What's at stake in this debate?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think that as we see both parties really identify more with sort of race-based ideologies or identity politics, as you could say, I mean, that's kind of dangerous because to some degree then what ends up happening is people feel far more personally attacked when their party loses. And there are sentiments that we saw among some folks who really identified more with a white nationalist vision who felt that way when President Obama was elected. And we certainly saw that many folks of different minority groups felt personally attacked when Donald Trump was elected. I mean, I think that the difficulty that both parties have as we move forward is it's really hard. It's very difficult to discuss public policy issues independent of race or culture because that's just become a part of so much of this conversation at this point.
And it's a conversation we will continue. Asma Khalid of NPR and Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, thank you both.
You're welcome.
Should Congressman Steve King's comments to the New York Times be called racist? As a reminder, last week, King, who's a Republican from Iowa, was quoted by a Times reporter as asking, rhetorically, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? End quote. Well, as NPR and other newsrooms have tried to characterize his comments, and I should note on air this week, I called them racist. NBC did not. NBC got some blowback this week when it advised its reporters not to use the word racist. They have since reversed course, but we still have some questions. So we have brought in NPR's Gene Dinby, who has got some strong views on this, to talk it through. Hi, Gene.
Hey, Mary Louise. Good to see you.
Good to have you with us. Okay, what exactly did NBC's guidance to its journalists say?
So NBC's standards editor sent out an email. We know this because the Huffington Post got their hands on it. The email said to, quote, be careful to avoid characterizing King's remarks as racist. It is okay to attribute to others, as in what many are calling racist or something like that. So after this big public outcry on social media over that email, NBC changed tack and said, quote, it is fair to characterize King's comments as racist and point out that he has a history of racist comments. Mm. And of course, this type of attribution, so-and-so says something is racist, that's, you know, a pretty common news convention. It's meant to suggest a level of neutrality or distance from the reporter, especially when covering something controversial.
Yeah, I think part of this is a desire not to label something. We report what someone they said and everybody can make up their minds what they
Absolutely.
Think of it, which is why you find a lot of journalists using terms like racial inflammatory or some other euphemism.
Yes. And that's not a new phenomenon. So the Cornell historian Lawrence Glickman recently outlined this long history of euphemisms like this, like racially charged and racially inflammatory and racial undercurrents.
Racially insensitive.
Racially insensitive, yeah. Right. That are used by news organizations reporting on some sort of racial controversy. Glickman wrote that this really started to pick up steam in the 1950s. He noted one particularly tortured example from the Associated Press that called bombings on the then recently desegregated campus of the University of Alabama as, quote, racially tinged explosions.
And to situate this, you said the 1950s, this started to change. Of course, that's when the civil rights movement was gaining steam.
Exactly. Philippa Tiba Goff, who is a psychologist we have on Code Switch a lot, who studies racism, he said that one of the most important consequences of the civil rights movement was to create these new taboos around racial animus. So being a racist, or at the time being prejudiced, became a bad thing. And so reporters who were trying to stay, quote, objective, were playing it safe by not characterizing the people that they were talking about as racist or prejudiced. And so to get deeper into this idea, if you primarily understand racism as a kind of like illness of the soul, right, a moral failing, you can't use that term unless you can sort of characterize what's happening in people's hearts. We as journalists can't really do that. But that's not the only way to understand something as racist, right?
Sure. Well, I mean, what would be another?
Well, a lot of people understand racism as just a structural reality, particularly people of color. If the United States was built on this history of ethnic cleansing of Native American people and the enslavement of black people, and then all these subsequent arrangements flow out of those things, then racism and white supremacy is just like part of the source code of American life. It doesn't need to be sort of discerned from people's souls. And these two understandings of racism, those things are butting up against each other when we're using this language in our news coverage.
So circle back to where we started and the controversy this week over Steve King and whether to call his comments racist. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, one thing we should say here is that it matters a lot that mainstream newsrooms are still predominantly white, right? And so that understanding shapes a lot of the guidance that newsrooms get, you know, and I think newsrooms should be much more comfortable just saying racist. And I would argue that Steve King's quote in the Times, which is a very literal defense of white supremacy, does not warrant this level of controversy. It's very straightforwardly racist.
We've been talking with NPR's Gene Dinby from our Code Switch podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
This is the week members of Congress voted almost unanimously to condemn their colleague, Steve King. The move was in response to the Iowa Republicans' defense of the terms white nationalist and white supremacist in a New York Times interview. Now, as Iowa Public Radio's Katie Pikus reports, King's constituents in western Iowa are pondering his political future.
It's breakfast time at the J&J Cafe in the northwest Iowa city of Lamars. At a table, there's a group of friends who meet daily to settle the world's problems. Today, they're talking about Steve King. Dennis Ashey and Dennis Toll have both voted for him in the past and say he's been treated unfairly.
You know, there's no freedom of speech anymore.
That's why this why they started this country, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, all that stuff, and now you can't talk anymore.
Two big Iowa newspapers have called on King to step down. But Ashey says King should keep his seat.
Why? Because of voter declinator. That's why. We voted him in there.
But their friend Walt Klein-Hesselink is not so sure.
I think he's been in there plenty long.
King has represented this corner of Iowa since 2003, easily winning re-election every time, until last November. That's when his history of making racist remarks caught up with him, and he eked out a narrow win. About 20 miles away is Sioux County, where King got some of his strongest support last fall. At the Town Square Coffee House and Kitchen in Orange City, co-owner Steve Marr says he voted for King in 2004, but now he wants King to go away.
He's made comments about my immigrant neighbors. He's made comments about the freedom of black people. He's been made comments about the superiority of Western civilization over other cultures and civilizations.
A couple of tables away, Bree Ellis says she agrees with King's strong anti-abortion positions and support for gun rights. But she doesn't like the terms King defended, like white supremacist, white nationalist, and Western civilization.
I think that one time Western civilization was an okay term to use, but I think that now times have changed, and when times change, you also need to change the way that you say things and do things and support things.
After the New York Times interview ran, King said he condemned white nationalism and supremacy, although he insists he's still a defender of Western civilization. But in a sign that his support here may be ebbing, a prominent local Republican has announced plans to challenge King in the GOP primary next year. For NPR News, I'm Katie Pikus in Sioux City, Iowa.
This is the city of Chicago.
To Chicago now, and news of the sentencing of former police officer Jason Van Dyke. Van Dyke got nearly 7 years in prison for killing black teenager Laquan McDonald. Here's Cook County Judge Vincent Gaughan.
This is a tragedy for both sides. So this is not easy, and I don't expect it to be easy. My findings are an appropriate sentence would be 81 months in the Illinois Department of Corrections, 2 years mandatory supervised release.
NPR Cheryl Corley joins me now from outside that courtroom in Chicago. Hey, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm all right, thanks. So to remind, a jury convicted Van Dyke last fall, and what he was convicted of was second-degree murder, 16 counts of aggravated battery. That judge could have sentenced him to anything from probation to life in prison. What was the reaction there in the courtroom to this sentence of 6 years, 9 months?
Well, you know, it depends really on who you are. I mean, the Van Dyke family, I think, was relieved because
Jason Van Dyke could have been
a lot worse. It could have been almost life in prison, a sentence that ranged from probation to almost 96 years, and he ended up with, you know, nearly seven.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of other people were disappointed that they thought that that it did a disservice to what happened to Laquan McDonald. So that's how it played out. So you had disappointment on one side and kind of relief on the other side of the courtroom.
Cheryl, I want to hear more about what happened in that courtroom today, but remind us just briefly of the facts of this case.
Well, Jason Van Dyke was one of the last officers to come on a scene where people were trying to get Laquan McDonald, a 17-year-old black kid, to put down a knife as he was walking down the street on Chicago's southwest side. People had called for help. He had slashed some tires of a truck, and he was being followed by a number of officers who were waiting for a taser. Van Dyke and his partner, they came on the scene, and Van Dyke got out of his car, and within seconds, he shot McDonald, and he shot him 16 times. And originally, the officer said that McDonald had tried to attack officers with a knife. That didn't prove to be true. That was shown on a dash cam video that was released about a year later that contradicted the story that police gave at the time.
Mm-hmm.
This case really caused massive protests in the city then. It caused the ouster of the Chicago police superintendent, the Cook County State's attorney. So people have really been keeping a close eye on what has happened with this case that's been going on for more than 4 years now.
And this sentencing decision came out a little bit later than we were expecting today. I gather that was in part because so many people were in the courtroom making statements, hoping to influence the judge one way or the other. What were you hearing?
Well, absolutely. You had, for Van Dyke, there were a number of retired police officers who came and spoke on his behalf. His family spoke on his behalf. And Van Dyke also spoke. The former head of the police union, Dean Angelo, said that Van Dyke was not the monster that people have made him out to be in the media and in political circles. He called him a big, gentle kid, a hard worker and a good dad. He called this whole event that happened in 2014 a perfect storm. And he said he knew that the murder wasn't something that Van Dyke had set out to do. It was interesting, too, because Van Dyke's brother-in-law, who is a black man, spoke on his behalf and also said Van Dyke was not racist. And, of course, there were statements by people who spoke against Van Dyke, Marvin Hunter, Laquan McDonald's great uncle, who read a letter that he said was in the voice of his nephew. He said he wanted the judge to know he hoped that no other black man or woman would have to face the evil of Jason Van Dyke.
You mentioned that this is a case that people in Chicago have followed very closely. There have been protests. I know the sentencing has just come down, so it's early hours yet. But what kind of reaction are you looking for in Chicago?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't think that when the verdict was going to be announced, there was all this preparation here because they thought that there was going to be, you know, a lot of emotional outbursts. But that hasn't happened here. People have called for calm. And so far, that's what we're seeing.
That's NPR's Cheryl Corley reporting from the courthouse in Chicago, where Jason Van Dyke has just been sentenced. Thank you, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
Not guilty. That's the verdict today for three Chicago police officers accused of lying about the 2014 police killing of Laquan McDonald. Prosecutors said the officers lied in an attempt to justify fellow officer Jason Van Dyke's decision to shoot McDonald 16 times. Prosecutors also claimed that dash cam video proved the officers were lying. The judge's decision is a major blow to police reformers. They had hoped that this case would send a message about the so-called police code of silence. Patrick Smith of member station WBEZ joins us from the courthouse in Chicago. Hi, Patrick.
Hey.
Remind us who these officers are and what they were charged with doing.
Yeah, so you have current officer Thomas Gaffney, former officer Joseph Walsh, and former detective David March. Prosecutors said that these three officers collaborated with Officer Jason Van Dyke and others in the police department to shape a false narrative about the shooting of Laquan McDonald, that they said that McDonald attacked the officers, that they said McDonald injured officers and forced Van Dyke to shoot, things that are contradicted by the infamous dash cam video of McDonald's death.
Now, this was a bench trial, which means a judge decided, not a jury. How did she explain her verdict?
Well, she really undercut the prosecution's whole case and undercut what I just told you. You know, seeing the dash cam video of the shooting seems to completely contradict what the officers put in their reports. What she said was that that video cannot be considered all of the evidence. And in fact, the fact that it's not from the perspective of the officers themselves is a reason to almost disregard it. It cannot tell us what really happened. I mean, she was saying, the prosecutor said the video proved this whole case. And she said, no, the video doesn't prove the case at all.
Only the officers involved in the incident know what their belief was at the time of the incident. We cannot now view the actions of the officers with the benefit of hindsight as to what they should have believed.
How have people in Chicago been reacting to this decision?
Well, you know, in the courtroom itself, I heard several police reform activists exclaim, you know, they said, wow, in this sort of disappointed disbelief. There were also a lot of police officers, police union members and supporters who were in the courtroom and cheered and congratulated each other on it. After, you know, the officers and the attorneys talked about their relief, activists talked about their concern that, you know, they were hoping this trial was going to send a message to officers that the code of silence, it's not okay to lie to protect other officers. And they were worried that this sent the exact opposite message. One person who spoke after was Laquan McDonald's great uncle, Marvin Hunter. He was one of many people I heard who said that this verdict today is proof that the code of silence protects police officers, and it extends all the way up to the bench.
I want the feds to come in because I have no confidence in what is happening. I think the Department of Justice, I think the feds need to come in, and I think they need to begin to investigate this for real, the whole Cook County justice system.
Now, tomorrow, the officer who killed Laquan McDonald, Jason Van Dyke, is scheduled to be sentenced. What do you expect to happen then?
Well, yeah, there's a whole range of options. You know, the defense attorneys, Van Dyke's attorneys, are asking that he be sentenced to probation only, no prison time at all. Well, prosecutors are saying he should be sentenced to 96 years in prison. Van Dyke was convicted of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery. Prosecutors say he should serve the minimum for each individual count. Well, defense attorneys say, no, he shouldn't go to prison at all. He should be sentenced on second-degree murder, which there is a possibility in Illinois of probation for second-degree murder.
Patrick Smith of member station WBEZ in Chicago, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And then I got into Memphis. And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Yeah. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers?
For 2 years, we lived in my husband's childhood home, feeling unsafe.
Former State Representative Kaya Morris stepped away from her House seat last year after a series of racial threats. Her husband getting emotional reading some of the online comments written about his wife.
That black racist don't tread on us. When the time comes for negotiations is over, whites will be ready for the war. Thanks for resigning. Now please move out of my state.
But Vermont's Attorney General T.J. Donovan says after 4 months of investigating, there's not enough evidence to prosecute anyone for some of the incidents that included vandalism and a home invasion, and he cannot take negative commenters to court.
I find the statements presented to us in this matter, while racist, insulting, and degrading, are not subject to prosecution. The Constitution does not permit us to prosecute racist speech because we find it offensive.
Instead, Donovan announced a new bias incident reporting system and new bias training for local law enforcement. Bennington police were questioned by some on their handling of a perceived death threat on Morris's husband's computer.
My agency has been completely cooperative with the Attorney General's office. We have provided every document. We've had conversation along the way. And that's a protocol that Mr. Donovan and I have agreed that needs to be worked on about how we take digital items that have digital capability, computers, iPads, iPhones, we get them to the Vermont State Police. There needs to be a protocol.
But as officials called for the community to come together, this happened.
I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Self-described internet troll Max Mish, who was named in the Attorney General's investigation and who Vermont Superior Court ruled had stalked Morris and had to stay away from her for a year in 2016, came wearing a Pepe the Frog t-shirt. It's an image some supporting Kaya Morris say is offensive.
Why do you have to walk into a valuable community conversation with that symbol of hate?
Because I can.
Now Morris says there's more work to do.
It unfortunately needs to be said that I am not the cause of racism in this state. Our local, regional, state economic challenges cannot be laid at my feet. It is not on me to make everyone whole again. Nor is it my burden to help us all heal from this moment. That is your work today.
Now, Donovan set up three community forums on hate crimes and bias incidents. The first one will be in Bennington next month. At the live desk tonight, Renee Wunderlich, NBC 5 News.
Our sick white brother.
In 1963, more than a dozen young girls were arrested for protesting segregation in Americus, Georgia. They were taken 30 miles outside the city and held in an old stockade, a rundown cement structure that once functioned as a prison.
There were days we were up all night looking at the door, hoping that somebody would come try to rescue us. But nobody came day after day.
I miss my mother more than anything. We just did what we could to try to console each other.
On this season of the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, we're bringing you stories of reunions. And in this week's episode, how a group of women came back together on their own terms to shine a light on an overlooked moment in civil rights history.
We have never talked about the stockade in 52 years. And I still don't like to talk about it. But this is a part of all of our lives.
I'm Jasmine Morris. Stay with us. In this week's episode, we'll take a few minutes to bring you the story of an overlooked moment in civil rights history, told by the women who lived it. In July 1963, more than 200 African-American protesters gathered in Americus, Georgia, for a series of demonstrations to end segregation. Police made several arrests that day, including more than a dozen teenage girls who were part of the peaceful protests. They spent the night in a county jail. But the next day, due to what the police called overcrowding, they were loaded onto a truck and driven to a small town called Leesburg. The girls, who were between the ages of 12 and 15, had no idea where they were. But with one guard standing watch, that's where they'd stay, in Leesburg, locked inside an old stockade, a small, square building with concrete floors, barred windows, and a broken toilet. Details which Carol Barner Say remembers all too well.
The place was worse than filthy. People wouldn't put their pets in such condition. It was hot. All kinds of insects flew in, cockroaches, mosquitoes, everything.
More than 50 years after their release, four of the girls, now women in their 60s, sat down for StoryCorps. Here's Carol again, along with Emmerine Kegler-Streeter, Shirley Green-Reese, and Diane Bowens.
I thought about my siblings. What are they doing? What is my mom cooking today?
I miss my mother more than anything. I just miss seeing her face every day.
Being in a place like that, I didn't feel like we was human.
We slept on the hard concrete floors, no water.
Our parents didn't even know where we were. And I had never been away from home. But a couple of us was very strong, and you was one of those persons.
We just did what we could to try to console each other.
After a week, it started messing with me mentally, as if no one cared. And there were days we were up all night, looking at the door, hoping that somebody would come try to rescue us. But nobody came. I gave up hope many days.
So did I.
I did not speak it, but it was a lot of crying in that place.
Yes.
After spending nearly a month in the stockade, the girls' parents found out where they were being held, but none of the families could afford bail. Around the same time, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, a major civil rights organization in the 60s, also caught wind of the situation. They sent one of their photographers to Leesburg, the now-renowned Danny Lyon, to document what was happening. One of his photos shows a group of girls, some facing the camera, some holding onto the barred windows, looking tired and confused. Other photographs show their living conditions. Conditions they lived with for the 2 months they spent locked inside the stockade. Next, how the girls made it out and put the past behind them until a reunion brought them back together more than 50 years later. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the all-new three-row Subaru Ascent. There's room for 7 or 8 passengers and a choice of second-row captain's chairs or bench seating. The Ascent also features standard symmetrical all-wheel drive for added confidence in all-weather conditions. The Subaru Ascent. Love is now bigger than ever. Learn more at Subaru.com.
Welcome back. After Danny Lyon's photographs were printed in a SNCC newsletter and several black-owned publications, the girls were released from the stockade in September 1963. Here they are again, remembering what it was like to finally return home.
My mom, she heated water on the stove because I hadn't had a bath in 2 months, and she was bathing me. My mama scrubbed, and she scrubbed. Finally, she stopped scrubbing, dried me off, and put me on some clothes. And my mom put me to bed like I was a baby.
When I came home, I stopped playing with my dolls, and my life became focused on what was going on in the world.
My classmates and my teachers never asked me where I was coming from. I felt like I didn't fit in. So after high school, I left the area and moved forward. So what I did, I got a job in the library.
and I saw this picture for the first time in my life, I said, this is us. And I felt like it was an embarrassing picture to me. I wasn't going to share that with nobody because I didn't want them to know I was in that jail. We never talked about the stockade, never, in 52 years.
But that changed in 2015 when Shirley organized a reunion for the Leesburg girls. As they reflected back, they remembered one of the girls, Verna Hollis, who had a particularly hard time during their imprisonment.
As days went by, we noticed that she was getting weaker and weaker, so we had to focus more on her.
You're right. If she ate, it would just come right back up. I was scared Verna was going to die.
Verna sat in one spot. We never saw her move.
If she moved, it had to be at night when we were asleep.
Had to be. But Verna never complained to us. If she complained to anybody, it was under her breath to God, but we never heard it.
After their release, Verna gave birth to that child, a baby boy. And 50 years later, the two of them sat down for StoryCorps.
When you was taken to the stockade, how did you feel when you first arrived there?
I was scared and mad. They could treat a human being like they treated us. We both could have died in there. Both could have died.
I couldn't believe that living in this town, I had never heard this story. I didn't know you were locked up.
You was like 13 or 14 when we told you about it. Because I wanted to put that behind me, really.
Out of all this, is anything that you're proud of?
You came out all right. Yeah, I've always been a good boy. I tell the world that.
You have been my inspiration as far as how to be strong. I'm proud of that. And I try to live from that.
That's Joseph Jones III speaking with his mother, Verna Hollis. Verna died in 2017 at the age of 68. But the history of what happened to her and the other Leesburg girls lives on. Carol wrote a book about the stockade, and Maureen and Shirley both went on to work in education.
If you could see the men who locked you up now, what would you say to them?
I think what I would say is, sir, I feel so sorry for you because they were not looking at us as children. They were not looking in the hearts. And all they were looking at was the fact that we were black.
I hope God touches the heart, the minds of the people that still feel like we're less.
That was Carol Barner Say, Emmerine Kegler Streeter, Shirley Green Reese, and Diane Bowens. Decades later, the stockade is still there, and it looks the same. There's no historical marker, no signs of what happened back in 1963. But for these women, it's something they carry with them always.
You didn't know this, but today, when I got in this elevator, I was about to have a heart attack. I just don't want to be closed in, and I don't want to be in the dark. I'm 66 years old, and I sleep with two lights on in my bedroom.
For me, it has been in my fibers for years, and I still don't like to talk about it. But this is a part of all of our lives.
Forever.
Forever.
None of the girls who were held at the Leesburg Stockade in 1963 were ever formally charged with a crime.
Black babies cost less.
We're following a new accusation from the attorney for Eric Black, one of two men charged in the death of Jasmine Barnes.
Eric Black's attorney claims some HPD investigators may have violated his client's rights while interviewing him. Channel 2 investigator Robert Arnold live downtown with this story. Robert?
Eric Black Jr.'s attorney was careful with his words. Nonetheless, he says investigators interviewed Black even after he says he told the court he no longer wants anyone in law enforcement questioning his client.
Either way, something is wrong here, and we need to get to the bottom of it.
Alvin Nunnery is the attorney for Eric Black Jr., who is one of two men charged with the murder of Jasmine Barnes.
It is a clear violation of both his substantive and procedural due process rights.
Nunnery says members of the gang task force interviewed Black on January 10th. He says this interview came 3 days after he says the court granted his motion that Black no longer be questioned by investigators.
And we need to know how involved that is to see whether it has tainted anything that they've already done.
Nunnery says he has asked the district attorney's office to provide the names of the officers involved in that interview at the jail and what exactly was discussed.
I want them to preserve their interview notes. I want to find out if they recorded the interview.
Nunnery says as soon as he has the names of the officers involved, he will subpoena them and call for a hearing. Nunnery says he is also asking whether the district attorney's office properly notified law enforcement they were to no longer speak with Black.
Every law enforcement officer knows or should know.
Nunnery was cautious not to say whether he feels this could jeopardize the case against Black. Now, investigators have said Black has admitted to driving the car used in Jasmine Barnes' murder, but implicated another man, Larry Woodruff, as the shooter. Woodruff, through his attorney, has denied any involvement. Officials with the district attorney's office declined to comment. Reporting live from downtown, Robert Arnold, KPRC, Channel 2 News.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 19, 2019, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, observations, counter-racist suggestions. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We lost the Wi-Fi signal for a brief period, about 35 minutes into the broadcast. The Wi-Fi signal totally disappeared. Ended up having to reconnect the modem. Came back after a few minutes. I suspect racist suspects. As usual, Wi-Fi's been on all day. Haven't had any problems. Not even any brief interruptions in service until we got ready to broadcast. Anywho, a few things before we get started. The final clip that I played was Jasmine Barnes, the 7-year-old Black female, Black little girl that was shot in Houston, killed in Houston, Texas, right at the end of the year. And they said it was a white male who did the shooting. That was the suspect at first. And then they arrested these two Black males and have now charged them with capital murder and saying that they did it. I think folks should continue to monitor this case. I think Red in Nevada and some others said that they were going to be mindful about this case moving forward, because the details that have been delivered thus far just don't seem to make a lot of sense. And now having allegations from Mr. Black and his attorney that you got some incorrect behavior with the way that he was interrogated. Not that that should be a surprise, but I know this is one of those that can kind of, I mean, it's incidents of terrorism all the time. So it's one of those that can be forgotten once people move on to something else. But we should monitor this case and really be mindful when more evidence hopefully comes out with the investigation, the trial, all of that. Be mindful of this report. We have listeners in the Houston area. Give us updates. That would be appreciated. A few things before we get to listeners, callers. The 10-year anniversary yoga retreat for the cows. I have been I don't know if I'd say inundated, but quite a few inquiries, more so than I initially thought, has been grand. I am not ignoring anyone. I'm not even being a lazy, shiftless Negro and getting all this together. It is quite a task. And the thing that makes it most difficult, as usual, the system of white supremacy. I can even pause before I give some of the details. Listeners have been so supportive. I inquired about getting graphics for the retreat so that we could have apparel, or at least t-shirts, you know, for the folks that come to the retreat. Inquired, got the graphics the day that I asked. Visit hiphopcartoons.ca, victim of racism, white supremacy, who's done tremendous work. Did our cows logo on the Facebook page, hiphopcartoons.ca, tremendous work. He's done a lot of videos on YouTube for Mr. Fuller's channel. I made an error. I contacted Cynical African, longtime investor as well at the cows. I contacted Cynical African by mistake, and he relayed the message, and I still got the image the very day that I asked for it in a matter of hours with exact specifications that I was talking about. I was just making an inquiry to see if it was possible, and bam, it arrived at a totally separate victim of racism, longtime listener in the great state of Virginia, had said, would it be possible to get some help? We're trying to get the pamphlet together. I mentioned it on the program so that people will have all the details about the retreat. Wasn't even able to speak with this victim, and wham, pamphlet appeared. Make any adjustments or edits, but here you go. Wanted to make sure I made an effort. Let me know if I can be helpful. There has been quite a bit of that with the retreat, with the program in general, but particularly with the retreat. Specifically, what has made it difficult in trying to get the retreat in a location where it is a Black-owned establishment and we won't be around white people has made it a bit more challenging. They tend to abuse and mistreat Black people. You talk about being a Black entrepreneur, buddy, you will be introduced to racism, white supremacy quickly, and add on to that property owner. So that has made it challenging, but I think we should be able to get the last details, get the pamphlet together, and send out a mass email within the next day or so, so that people will have ample time to plan, coordinate all of that traveling for the event. Still looking at February 21 to February 24, but definitely racism, white supremacy has been at the center of making it difficult to organize and get it together. Again, if we were just going to pick a location that white people owned, controlled, whatever, we would have had this in Seattle, which was my original thought process. We would have just done this in Seattle, got a white-owned hotel or retreat or what have you, and that would have been that. But we are moving forward. Jackson, Tennessee, Black-owned establishment, and the details within the next day. I think we should have it all together. The pamphlet, have it on my computer right now. We can make a last couple adjustments, send that out. All of the droves of people who emailed, again, I am not ignoring. You were not left out of the communique with all of the details. It will be forthcoming. Racism, white supremacy has made it challenging, but hopefully it will be worthwhile. If you did not send out the email and would like details about the 10-year anniversary Cows Yoga Retreat, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I will happily include you so that you have all of the information. That's it. In addition, we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio invest. If you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all of the investors for a decade. That is the reason that we have remained on the air, listener-supported, as well as folks hitting the wish list at Amazon.com. It is linked under Gus T. Renegade. Huge amount of gratitude. Thanks to all of the folks who have contributed. I hope it has been worthy of your time and energy, and I hope the cows has provided accurate, consistent information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white, and things that we can do to go about solving this problem immediately. Few other details before I get to the folks who dialed in. Let's see, I made notes when they began talking. There we go. Raymond Walters, when they talked about academic publishing, and I can even give a pause right there. The segment on academic publishing I thought was so important, reminded me of Dr. Tommy Curry, the Man Knot. He had an extensive section in the book we just finished talking about trying to publish, talking about black males, and you will immediately encounter white supremacist resistance, not institutional racism, not racially insensitive scholars. No, you will encounter white supremacy racism. Didn't he give the exact quote in the email? They wouldn't publish his article on black male suffering. Here we go again, talking about the black male niggers. Get out of here, Dr. Curry. We don't want to hear that. That was the first thing I thought of. And then Al Jazeera, the stream. I am not a supporter of Al Jazeera at all. However, they do have constructive content from time to time. Some years back, I believe it was 2016. I'm going to pull up the exact video. It was only about 30 minutes long, so you can watch it. Al Jazeera did a report about white supremacy racism in the publishing industry. Now, the segment that they played today, they were talking about academic publishing, which is important. That's where you get the bell curve, right? You know, people can, and Super Predators, that was an academic journal. That was also in Dr. Curry's The Man Knot. Academic publishing is a very special field, but publishing in general, Al Jazeera's segment, they said, oh yeah, you definitely got racism, white supremacy in the publishing industry. However, the individuals who control what niggers get published and why so many niggers do not get published, that is not the domain of white men at all. The Al Jazeera segment, they said about 75% of the people who control the decisions about what book is going to be published, again, it's not white men, it's white women who make those decisions about whose name is going to be on a book jacket. Hugely important. It's not racist man, it's racist woman, racist man, racist child. And I almost included that segment to give a segment where it's all males talking and they're talking as though it's all white males in the academy who are responsible for this. Nothing could be further from the truth. Again, The Man Knot, Dr. Curry, women increasingly are taking over in the academies. It's more of them there. They would have to be playing a role in this. How could they not? Continuing. Oh, wait a minute. Even from the same segment, the white male being interviewed, he said, our journal, we published an article about school segregation. It was written by Raymond Walters, and our editorial staff, you know, they were lazy or shiftless or, you know, whatever it was, but they didn't pay attention that Raymond Walters had morphed into a white supremacist. Wow. So I guess Raymond Walters was cool. He was wearing Bill Cosby t-shirts. He hung out with niggers. He marched with Dr. King. He was in Selma and got beaten. James Meredith was his biggest fan. And then one day, he morphed into a white supremacist and submitted an article with dog whistles about racism that they still published. And I think he said they repudiated it, although they did not retract it, which I think, why not retract it? If you made an error and this guy's a white supremacist, according to your own testimony, why not retract the report? Why would we even want to give a platform to a white supremacist to spew his racist, vile views? Continuing. NPR, now I talked about them last week, the segment that they did on R. Kelly. This week, they had the segment with Mary Louise Kelly, white woman suspected racist. She was the white reporter at NPR. When they had the portion talking about Steve King, and they were specifically talking about NBC and their, I guess, first directive that Steve King should not be labeled as a racist, which is not a surprise at all. That is standard racist code, and they did give a pretty nice history of deceptive language. One of the things that I thought was racist and a problem, incorrect, I won't even say it was a problem, was highly incorrect. There was a lot of snickering in that report. Now, they're talking about bombings. They're talking about incidents of terrorism and saying racially tinged, racially charged, racially insensitive. What I've said for a decade, white supremacy racism is a crime. Is there any other crime that journalists or anyone else reports on where they say, I have to be so committed to being neutral and objective that even when someone is suspected of a crime, I have to obfuscate the language that this person is suspected of a major crime? Is that what they did with Jerry Sandusky when they talked about him? Did they say that Jerry Sandusky is suspected of being sexually insensitive with children? Is that the way that they framed the dialogue? No, they said he was a suspected pedophile, suspected rapist. Jeffrey Dahmer, when he was chopping up, raping, and eating mostly non-white males in the great state of Wisconsin, did they say that, you know, we got a suspected insensitive human muncher? What are you talking about? Use accurate language. Isn't the quote, the beginning of knowledge is to call things by their proper names. No one does it better. That's why I emphasize on this broadcast those metaphors. No one does it better. When we say master deceivers, that right there is one of the primary ways that they practice white supremacy racism. All these nonsense terms. I say it every week. Marginalized. They just keep coming up with them and keep coming up with them. Use correct language, and really terrorism, white supremacy, racism. Use accurate language to indict what it is that they're talking about, even with Mr. Steve King. And then Mary Louise Kelly in the same segment, white woman, she goes to ask Gene Demme, black male, do you think what Steve King said is racist? Anytime you have a white person, system of white supremacy, and the white person is asking a black person, do you think this is racist? No. Do you think, Mary Louise Kelly, white woman, do you think this is racist? That is much more important. Black people saying that they think something is racist is totally irrelevant. And frequently, a lot of black people have gotten in trouble for indicting a white person as racist. Didn't Kanye West, although I said I didn't want to hear his name mentioned on the program anymore, but lots of black people have gotten in trouble for indicting, saying that, oh yeah, I think such and such a white person is racist. No, no. When it starts to get serious, when another white person says, oh, yeah, I think Steve King is racist and I think he needs to go, that's when we start having serious conversations about, uh-oh, Steve King might lose his job. Not when niggers say, oh, yeah, I think Steve King is racist. Who cares? Next, that's no Mr. Demby can take whatever position he wants, as do I. It's just emphasizing the counter-racist logic. Victims have much less power. Who cares about their indictments? Mr. Demby or myself or anyone else saying that such and such a white person is racist. Who cares? That does not matter at all in the system. Whites can show you better than I can tell you in that regard. Next. The case with Jason Van Dyke, the officer that was convicted, sentenced to, what was it, I think, 81 months. I thought that was another example of how racists skillfully use language. Most of the reports that I've seen, it's shown that he was sentenced to 81 months. In my experience, once the sentence goes over 5 years, once we start getting into the 100 month range, they generally just say, how many years did the person get? 6.5 years, whatever it is, less than 7 years. That's generally the way it's done, at least in my view. The initial reaction, oh, right, soldier got convicted and sentenced to 81 months. Like, oh, wow, 81. That's what you would see, as opposed to less than 7 years or 6.5 years, approximately. I think even that, very skillful. I don't think they gave a number of months when Bill Cosby got locked up, how many. They were talking years in terms of what he's going to be sentenced. And you can think of the other black people that get charged and sentenced. Did they give out sentences where they list the number of months that you're going to be locked up, or the number of years? Again, unless it's a 6-month sentence, 12 months, an 18. That's about the cusp generally for what I've seen, an 18 months. Since after that, it's how many years are we talking about so we can make an evaluation? 6.5 years for killing a teenage black male. With that, again, for this broadcast specifically, exclusively, this is the only one I request, if we cannot use metaphors, racists skillfully employ metaphors to practice racism. Again, no one does it better. They will use analogies, similes. They will make a lot of comparisons frequently to suggest that two separate entities are identical, and often that is not the case at all. Heard one of them in the segment. In fact, they were talking about Donald Trump. They were talking about the 2016 election with Donald Trump, and they said that you had many black people who felt offended or aggrieved about Donald Trump in 2016, just like you had many white people who felt uncomfortable when President Obama was running. That right there, in my view, would be exactly what I'm talking about with those comparisons. Now, if, as I recall, and as the evidence shows, there were black people who were being assaulted at Trump rallies, even some white people who were being assaulted, I do not remember calls to violence. Remember President Trump, didn't he say, boy, I wish if it was good old days, I would go out there and get that guy. Didn't he say that at the rally? I don't remember that ever happening at a rally with former President Obama, where there were calls to violence and videos of white people being assaulted at, you know, the Hope rallies from 2008 or 2012. I do not remember that at all. So if white people did feel that way, and it seems a lot of them did, it would have to be totally different than what was happening in 2016 with Donald Trump and the flagrant violence that was on display throughout his campaign. That's what I mean about those metaphors. Frequently, they're comparing things that are not alike at all. That is a part of the deception. Victims such as myself, we've been exposed to this behavior for a long time. Many of us, including myself, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't have the logic to articulate our views. We'll substitute a metaphor, an analogy, and often that just contributes to a lot more confusion. If we could speak directly, explicitly to what it is that we want to say, that would be super appreciated. With that, again, if we have any folks in the, or I was going to say, certainly if you're in the Houston area, but if you're in that part of Texas and you have been keeping up with the Jasmine Barnes report, always great to get information on that. Again, I'll encourage folks to be mindful of that case, even though we're getting some distance from the actual murder of the young black girl, but be mindful about that report. It would be great to get updates from folks in the Texas area, or even if you are not in Texas and you're keeping up with that. Last two things I'll say, we should be here tomorrow for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. And we should be here on Tuesday. Anne Michelson, this is a white woman. She is in Norway. We read The Hate U Give, formerly the worst book I ever read. We read that, and Miss Michelson was suggested, because this is a white woman who says, oh, this is a wonderful book, great book. It does a great job explaining the plight of the Negroes, and everyone should read it. We'll do better. We'll get rid of racism, and Black Lives Matter. Read this here book. She teaches it with her classes in Norway. She should be here on Tuesday. It's a 9-hour time difference between here and there, so it'll be irregular time, like, what is it, 2? It'll be 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Central, 11 a.m. Pacific, Tuesday. That's the live time. The folks that were with us for The Hate U Give, I got your back. You can email your question if you want to ask this white woman something about the book or the movie, whatever. I'm sure she's seen it. You can email if you know you can't participate live at that time, and I will ask. But I'm very much looking forward for folks who saw, heard all of that. What an experience. But that'll be Tuesday. Always look forward to chatting it up with suspected racists. With that, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am. Got your back. She was with us.
What a metaphor. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hopefully everyone's having the best evening they can possibly have. excuse me. Congratulations on moving forward with the yoga retreat. If I can suggest, if you have... That's my mom. sorry about that. If you have the ability to make a generic T-shirt, sorry about that, a generic T-shirt so that other people can purchase it, even though they may not be able to go, that may offset some of the cost. You know, something to think about. If you have a segment on Black people forgiving, could you please, I know this is a request, could you give us a warning, like, you know, you play the Obama videos about, oh, the kids are getting better, and we know they're not. I don't know if I can take any more forgiveness. I know this, they're right, and I'm very sorry that they went through what they went through. I am thankful that they have survived and are able to tell their stories. I just can't take that anymore. I feel for them, but, you know, it does seem like you do have a mental health issues, especially hearing what they went through. The academic segments, those were, I think, very good. There is definitely a problem, and it starts very early. I know when I was going through my program, we read a paper about people, I guess, working together based on certain things. And I brought up, well, sometimes Black people tend to gravitate towards other Black people. And, of course, the white teacher looked at me like I was crazy. And as a student, I hadn't had full enough academic experience and knowledge to further explain that. But I'm like, I know what was going on. And they just kind of brush aside your experience, like whatever you experience is, you know, is rare and comes from some place that they've never really heard of. It's a lot. And also, I guess, I don't know if you've talked a lot about that shutdown thing. It's really getting on my nerves. I don't care about the immigrants that much that are illegal. I care about legal people, citizens, again. The water in Flint, the water in Mounds County, Alabama. The little children down there are in sewers. They literally walk around with sewage in their front yard, and no one cares. No one's doing anything. And the young lady, I guess she was Iranian. I guess technically, publicly, she is described as probably as a woman of color or something. But according to the census, the federal government, those people are white, so I'm not really that concerned. They're supposed to be changing their status. When their status changes, maybe I will have more concern. Thank you.
Much obliged. I guess that's a, what do they call it, a trigger warning for forgiving racists in the future. I think that was the request. I'll have to be mindful of that as we proceed. Other folks, if you have a hand up, our line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I'm not familiar with the term trigger warning. What does that mean?
It's become popular in the last, I'll say, 2 to 3 years. College campuses, and even a lot of news reports, NPR, they might have said it today. If there's a segment and it's going to be something dealing with mistreatment or trauma, if it's a segment and they're talking about white supremacy and someone's going to say, oh, the nigger did this, or some reason that they'll have to say nigger, they might say, oh, there's a trigger warning, meaning that if you are upset, triggered, that's a term that they'll use in mental health sometimes. People that have been victims of white supremacy and other victims of trauma, different things will remind them about that. All right. Got disconnected again. And it was the Wi-Fi. Again, got disrupted. Should be here. I think the caller who was asking the question. I got disconnected while I was giving the response. Again, trigger warning. It's become popular in the last few years. It just is generally a warning for victims of trauma. If something will come up that might remind them of their specific trauma or victimization, like if someone's going to use the term nigger, or if it's going to be something about sexual abuse or sexual violation of some sort, they will say this is a trigger warning so you can be prepared if you want to turn the volume down or not listen to this segment so that it won't, you know, remind you of the terrorism or trauma that you've experienced, if that explains. Sorry for the disruption. Usual suspects. The male caller who had that question, did that answer your question, sir? I'm not sure. I thought he was there. Did that answer your question, sir? Or did you get disconnected?
I got disconnected. I apologize.
Oh, okay.
I heard some of your explanation at the beginning, as far as certain words being used to, I guess, trigger certain emotions or whatever to that extent. Am I correct?
Meaning trigger warning, just meaning this is a warning to anyone listening. The subject that we're about to talk about may reference a trauma. It might reference a subject matter that will remind you of how you have been terrorized, victimized. So it might, if we're going to talk about sexual misconduct, sexual harassment, if you've been a victim of some sort of sexual abuse, this might be traumatic for you. So you might not want to listen. If we're talking about racism, and they're going to be saying nigger, this might be traumatizing for you, so you might not want to listen. It's just a warning, so you can know if you want to ignore the segment, turn the volume down. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. That's all you had, or did you have other commentary?
Yes, I had other commentary.
Proceed.
So I've been listening to the show maybe about 7 years. And I've gained a lot from listening to this podcast. When I try to share it with friends, they're not as they don't receive the information, you know. But it has helped me, you know. Like, people make New Year's resolutions. You know, my New Year's resolution was to attempt to be more patient with other Black people. And, you know, to be more patient, because I've been being patient, you know, and attempting to be more patient with Black people prior to 2019. You know, in certain ways, you know, I mean, the tipping aspect is one thing, and then the you know, doing the surveys when you go out to eat and you put a Black person's name down, and you know, you tell them, you say that, hey, the service that I received was good, and you know, that might save a Black person from getting fired, you know, just to be able to go back to the survey or something. But you know, it's gotten to the point with me where when I'm driving, I'm looking at Black people's license plates to see if they're expired, and they're riding around with tags that might be dead. And, you know, I might ride up next to them and say, hey, you know, your tags are dead. And they're like, oh my God, I didn't know, you know. So, you know, I definitely think that that's one thing that has been expressed by a lot of, you know, ancestors and what being that we need to do in order to, you know, resolve this issue. On another note, you know, I live in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm a Department of Defense contractor, you know, and you know, I haven't been affected by the government shutdown. My honest opinion is, you know, white people want to do what white people do. So, you know, as far as black people, and I might, this might be a metaphor, you know, I'm, you know, white people won't do what white people won't do, but black people, I feel, need to mind their business. You know, we should mind our business and let, you know, whatever white people are going to do, it is what it is. So, I don't know if I went beyond my 5 minutes, Gus, but, you know, thank you for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged. Thank you so much. That is a great, I guess, resolution, if that's what folks call it, to be more patient with black people. Spectacular. And I think that is very common. And in my view, is evidence of how effective the system of white supremacy is, that frequently when sharing other victims of racism, constructive information that is very counter to the logic and the way that we often think about racism, white supremacy, they are not receptive to it. Because I've had that has been my experience for years with lots of literature. Dr. Welsing's work, Mr. Fuller's work, Dr. Marumba Ani, Dr. Cambon, long, lengthy list. So that's very common. And I think Dr. Ani and many others have talked about that, that if you have content or concepts that are counter to the white supremacist logic that we have been infected with, a lot of times we will be very resistant to that. So not anything to be surprised about. Again, you just try to be more patient, and I try to wait until victims are receptive to hearing a different way of thinking. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, much obliged for attempting to share the content. That is always appreciated, folks making the effort. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Irie.
Ah, good evening. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. I'm actually a little bit upset. It's been a rough week. A friend of mine sent a picture that was taken from Waco, Texas, of a huge statue of a gorilla on all fours, dressed in an Uncle Sam-esque outfit, but without the top hat. And I didn't know what to make of that, but I can't remember which segment was talking about Texas, but I thought I'd bring that up. A few weeks ago, doing rideshare, I actually gave a ride to the airport to a white female that shared with me that she works for a publishing company and that it is her position to go and negotiate the deals for the authors so their books can be carried in stores and online overseas, and, you know, everyone gets paid, et cetera, et cetera. So I find it interesting to learn that here we are again, white women. Hello?
Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. So it's interesting to find out here they are again dominating another area of people activity. Education, entertainment, I guess publishing would fall into that. I mean, well, all of it, really. And then the last thing I want to share is you know, I need to find someone to talk to, like, about these encounters and these experiences I'm having, because I'm tired. I'm stressed out. I have fatigue. Like, racism, the quote, I thought about the quote where they said white people are greatly pained by racism. That's not true. That's not true. We are. I am. There was a fourth grade young man I had to substitute for a paraprofessional or whatever, and she pushes in to a classroom to help certain teachers at certain times of day, and I went into this classroom and saw that the kids were working on projects. And this white female teacher basically on purpose took the most obviously black male child and singled him out to work on a project alone, which would have made it impossible for him to complete, and I knew that. And she walked over to him, and I just stood back and watched her body language and listened to the tone of her voice, and she's like, well, what are you doing? Well, you know you got to do this, and you got to do this, and you got to do this. Are you going to remember? And she's pointing at his poster paper and touching it with her foot, as though it's like garbage on the street or something. And I said to myself, whatever it takes, I have to be back to make sure this young man gets the most constructive help possible. So I went to the principal and I said to the principal, is it okay with your permission that I return here on a voluntary basis to make sure this student receives his help to finish his project? He has no partnership. He has nobody to work with, and he can't do it alone. And the principal was, he's non-white, considered Hispanic. He lit up and said, really, you're willing to come back unpaid? I said, yes, this is really necessary. And he said, absolutely. And I just thank God that he said okay, because the last time I noticed something, which I share with you all, the last time I said something to a principal about someone being mistreated, I was dismissed. So I returned to the teacher's chagrin, of course, but we completed the project, and I drilled the young man on the information, and he knew the information. He just needed someone to help him manifest it. And something told me to tell him, listen, I said to him, please listen to me. I want you to know that I know you did the best you could, but it's possible you still might get a bad grade. But you remember that you did your absolute best on this project, no matter what. And he said, it's okay, I know, because she's not the only teacher that's mean to the black kids. I didn't ask him to say that. I didn't say anything about being black to him. He told me that. And this is, it's tiring me out. It's killing me to hear that that lady went to that stockade and was in the condition she was in for 2 months, and then to hear that she died at 68, that's young. That experience took life, took years off of her life. When I think about my grandmother, and I'm going to wrap up because I know I'm taking up time, but my grandmother had a permanent hump in her back from where the years of work that she did, the years of work she did when she was young, sharecropping and picking cotton. And I just, I'm tired, and I kind of want to know, I don't know what we're going to do. People don't want to get on cold. They don't want to read Mr. Fuller's book. They don't want to change their behaviors. And then we have to somehow contend, the rest of us who are practicing counter-racism, we have to contend with white people, white supremacy, and victims who want to stay victims. I'm in a deluge. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for being patient with me and letting me share, everyone. Thank you, Gus. Good night, everybody.
Thank you for sharing, Irie. That is like monumental black self-respect. I mean, Dr. Welsing, I think, would be proud. I mean, to stay and volunteer to help a black child finish their project to the chagrin of the teacher. Suspected race soldier, she said, white woman, to come back in to help him. That is spectacular. Now, his commentary as well, because I was just thinking about that today in terms of us not talking to our offspring about racism. Black children are brilliant. That right there. Dr. Welsing in the ISIS papers, when she has the portion, she's talked about it on programs, but I mean, it is in the book, where she says that an 11-year-old black child, she said, hey, don't you want to go to school, get A's on, you know, your projects and everything so you can help black people? And he said, oh, no, you do that, you know, white people will get you at 11. Brilliant. Brilliant. This young child that you just talked to down in New Orleans. Brilliant. I'm not ignorant. I see this every day. It's tons of teachers. They hate us. They hate all of us. They have already done the math. Brilliant. We're not ignorant. We understand racism, white supremacy. And I hear so many folks who have consternation. They are chagrined about the prospect of talking to their children about racism. They're already being victimized. They were being victimized from conception. And by the time they're 10, 11, oh yeah, they are probably already seeing and picking out. They might not have the language to say, oh, yeah, that's suspected race soldier teacher. They might not have the language to do all that. But, I mean, they can see. It's glaring. It's glaring. And they can be honest about things that are happening. Sometimes that can be more difficult as we get older. But to your frustration, because I think there was a question or request or statement about needing to talk to folks. I don't know if that's finding other folks specifically in your area or just being able to have some reach out and talk conversations. But I know we have other listeners that are in the Louisiana, New Orleans area. So if you all want to chat it up, you all can drop me an email and maybe you all can coordinate if it's other teachers. I know we have quite a few educators who do listen to the program. So if you want to talk to some other educators, they could email me untiljustice@gmail.com and I could share that way. But it definitely sounds like this is why we're doing the Cows Yoga Retreat. Stopping to replenish when you feel like you're at that point, like, wow, I'm exhausted. I'm stressed. I'm frustrated. Really finding time for self-care, for maintenance. Even Dr. King, if you read several of the biographies on him, he used to try to take vacations to go to Jamaica or get away to do something. He and Coretta, Scott King, to take trips to get away just because that stress, exactly as you mentioned, that's why you end up having people dying at such a young age. We talked about that for a long time. So definitely do some things to manage your self-care. That is super serious when you're that frustrated and seeing Black children being terrorized like that every day. I can totally understand why. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, questions, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
All right. Greetings, greetings. How will I be heard now?
It's still a little low. Maybe you could get closer to the microphone and use lots of Black self-respect so you can speak up.
Can I be heard?
Ah, much better, much better.
Much better. Greetings, greetings, everyone. Hope everybody's having a constructive evening. I want to first send out, like I said, a applause of Black self-respect to Irie for her efforts to help the student. A couple of questions. I'd like a couple of questions and some commentary. The Jasmine Barnes case, like I said, definitely I was one of the people who was suspicious of how the narrative was changed. So I definitely will be keeping a will be paying closer attention to how the case proceeds. The questions I have, three of them, or four of them. Have you ever had opportunity to talk with Stacey Patton? I know you spoke with Asada Kirkland. She also is a person who is a advocate for not beating Black children. That was the first one. And if I'm not mistaken, did you ever have opportunity to do a book study on Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win People and Influence Others? I forget the title, pardon. And did you ever do a segment on body language and handshakes? And the last one, does anybody have views on, or in the New York area have views on the Women's March splintering into two different rallies, marches, where it, I guess, centered around some of the organizers being participants in the Minister Farrakhan's march last year. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
I'd be interested to hear people in New York's thoughts on that. I know some of them are with us. The first three questions, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Yes, that was read in the book study. We did the whole book. I didn't have to read that one. That was 2013. Summer of 2013, we read that one. Stacey Patton has not been a guest on the program. I am familiar with her work. She wrote a great article for the Washington Post when Toya Graham was crowned Supermom of the, or Mom of the Year. That's what it was. Mom of the Year for the corporal punishment beating her child after the so-called riots in Baltimore 2015. But she has not been a guest on the program. Body language. Yes. 2012. And that might be one that we've talked about on more than one occasion, but at least 2012. Dr. Khalif Muhammad was a guest on the program, and there were a number of books that we looked at that were talking about different ways that people lie and are deceptive. Nonverbal communication was a part of that. I think Nonverbal Judo, that was one of the books that we looked at. And there was another book in that same conversation that talked about different types of nonverbal communication, nonverbal behavior to be mindful of. And I know Roz mentioned a book on the compensatory call-in not too long back that was all about nonverbal communication and really studying what people are doing with their body movements. So I know it's been brought up repeatedly. Those are the three questions for me. All right. So as we move forward, all the folks that we've not heard from, if you have a hand up, proceed. And the other question, folks in the New York area, if you want to comment on the splintering of the Women's March.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. This is Red in Nevada. First thing I wanted to mention was the clip about Steve King. I know there was a couple of clips about him, but with the Iowa residents, when they were giving their opinions, I always think it's kind of funny because there was a man who had said something about, you know, the country was founded on, you know, religious freedom and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, that didn't make sense because you didn't allow some people to practice religious freedom, but just really trying to be more mindful of, you know, their words. That's what I've been trying to practice within, you know, my life more so. Also, I don't know if anyone had heard about the whole Gillette, like the razor. They did like a online commercial to kind of go along with the Me Too takeover, white woman takeover movement, saying how bullying is bad and this, that, and the other. And there was one part, because I watched the commercial a couple of times. The main premise was, you know, making sure, or I guess, where they were basically talking about bullying and men not sexually harassing women, literally, because there was a white man who, there was this one scene, a white man was in a walking out of a store and a white woman was walking by. I think she had like a halter top and some, I don't know, some other revealing bottom or pants or shorts, whatever. And he kind of had like this presence of him that was, maybe he was going to say something to her about her outfit. But then they had this black male kind of step in. He was like, no, don't do that, to kind of stop him. But the thing that I found most interesting was that there was no talk about, you know, racism, because I guess racism is, you know, not considered bullying. But they did have a short part where black males, there were some black males, like a group of black males kind of about to start fighting, and then another black male kind of talked them out of fighting. And then response to that, there was a white man who had he actually took a picture with his children. It was a little white girl and two white boys, and they were, I think all except for the white girl, they were holding guns. And so I forgot who did the article. It was actually an article about, one second, it says dad and his children pose for family photo carrying guns. Hey, Gillette, does this offend you? And this was actually a Yahoo article. And to me, the picture looked like, you know, a family of terrorists, you know, and these boys, or I'm sorry, the young men, the young white men, they look to be about, between 6 and 10. There's one holding a rifle, and it looks like they're actually holding these guns in a cotton field. which is not enough or whatever, but the one who's holding the rifle looks like it's about as tall as him. The other thing was, I thought it interesting, Ivy's commentary about, you know, trying to help out the black male, which is definitely black self-respect, but then how she said the principal said, you know, making sure that she was not going to get paid for it, but it was still okay. So I thought that was, you know, I think, not just I think, but I've also witnessed that and, you know, been through that same thing. Even if you want to help out, you know, other black people, you know, you need to make sure that you're not going to get paid for it. And if I'm not mistaken, I feel like there might have been either a article or a clip or something like that. And it spoke about how black people during like elections, they're not paid volunteers, but the white people are. The last thing I wanted to talk about was, of course, the opioid epidemic. I know I haven't been speaking about it recently, but New York Times, they had an interesting article because, you know, they have, it's something that white people really obsess over, but it was actually talking about how the opioid epidemic, it kind of, it's more prevalent, of course, in the Northwest, the Midwest, but also they found it was more prevalent in areas where these drug companies are allowed to give doctors so many different things to kind of market their medicines. And it made me remember when I would go to the doctor and you would see all like the little, they'll give you a bunch of samples for certain things and how some of these companies are spending tens of thousands of dollars on these doctors. And then they saw a direct correlation between how much money was spent on these doctors and how many opioid prescriptions were written. And also the last thing, I'm sorry, is about Jasmine Barnes. And I have been still trying to keep up with it, but the main thing is that they're still not saying how these black males are really tied to, are really linked to the crime. Not even saying, well, you know, these people were in gangs or, you know, any type of past criminal history, which they, you know, racists love to typically bring up. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Great points on the Jasmine Barnes case. That's why I said folks should definitely be mindful about this case. Don't, you know, just forget. I'm going to try and make sure that I'm following, taking heed to my own suggestion so that I'm also seeking out reports and information on this, and I will share. But help, definitely appreciated. We can all hold each other accountable, as they say. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up. Oh, wait a minute. Before I, the segment on Kia Morris, the state representative in Vermont, I played that. Victim of white terrorism. She resigned her position. She was a state representative. That's not just, you know, working at McDonald's. She resigned her position at the end of the year. She was subjected to vandalism, home invasion, and threats of lethal violence. This is all according to multiple reports. The attorney general in Wisconsin, white man, decided not to charge her. She gave a news conference. I played it. You heard some of the attorney general and enforcement official giving all their, for the same thing they said about Stephen King. We got U.S. Constitution, free speech. People can say whatever they want. If they want to call her a no good nigger, then, you know, that's their right. So they did all that. But before they gave the explanation, I'm going to watch a video about a black female who's a victim of terrorism. I was going to play that on workplace racism. Home invasion, no less, and they're not going to prosecute. But before I get that, I got to listen to a whimpering white male who happens to be her husband. I did not know this was a tragic arrangement situation as well until today. I saw this report like months ago. We talked about it before. I suspect that is probably one aspect of why race soldiers were mistreating her and still are. Oh, tragic arrangement. We got this uppity nigger in office and she's married to a white man. Terrorize the both of them. We got a no good nigger lover and we got this no good coon in office. And we're just going to go to work terrorizing both of them. Very important. I thought she's a victim in many, many, many ways. Talk about, you know, trauma and mental health damage, all of it. Being married to a white man and then being subjected to that sort of intense white terrorism to the point that you have to leave your job and then you go to give your press conference and a weeping white man steps forward to read all of the atrocities that have been launched against you. Wow. I had to make sure I got in a comment about that as well. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Let's get Princess first, then we'll get Thomas in New York.
Thanks. Good evening. I will just pick up where you just left off to point out the fact that upon me listening to that particular meeting that they had, I did note on some of the comment threads you had some Me Too activity in there that was suggesting that Black males, the lack of their presence in this matter, were not coming to her aid. And again, I have a problem with the fact that these feminists, Black feminists, feel that it is the responsibility of Black heterosexual males to come to the rescue of Black females who are engaged in tragic arrangements, and white society shows their themselves that somehow we're supposed to make Black males to blame and be held accountable for rescuing them from the racist onslaught. So I did note that. Also, as far as the Women's March, I think it's a good thing that Black women are or may appear to be taking notice of the behavior and hypocrisy of white women. I will hold my breath, though, because like the other female caller said, just dealing with Black people who just want to forgive and give a pass to some of the stuff that white people put us through or put Black people through, that is a trigger. So just like with this whole Kia thing in Vermont, I reading through the thread, it just seemed like people were given some type of empathy and justification for this, but I just simply could not imagine if she was in a relationship with a Black male and a Black male was standing up there whimpering and whining about how he wasn't able to protect his wife, his Black wife, how that would fly in the comment section. And as well as, you know, what people would say in general in society. I'll let the other person speak for now, but those are the two main things that I noted.
Much obliged, Princess. Thomas in New York, thank you for your patience, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Starting a few years back, got to give it to Texas. Gus, remember that book? They said, going to Texas, GTT, you know, they not giving up their niggas. You know, they just taking their niggas and going to Texas and bait to take their property. We had Micah Johnson, the bombings, Amber Geiger. Whatever happened with that, I'm waiting to hear more details about that case. And now Jasmine Brown. Now, I saw the sketch. I even said it looked like Steve Nash. One thing, Black people are confused. But we don't get Black people confused with white people. Like, that's just a big confusion there. Like, that sketch, there's no way that you're even looking for a Black suspect. You know, it just doesn't add up. However, you know, it could be, you know, in the condition we're in, you know, Black people did it, but just doesn't add up based off of the sketch. The story Ivy said about this young boy was serious and, you know, heartfelt. I'm glad she went back, and I'm glad the young man wasn't confused. He understood what was being done to him, you know. Like, pretty much, hey, I ain't expecting too much out of this chick anyway. So he's doing better than a lot of adult Blacks. The Women's March, what I saw was a fight for control.
You have the feminist movement, which was a pretty much an organic movement. And then you got the women's movement, which came up right behind that and kind of took over the feminist movement. And that's that Jewish controlled thing that is the mouthpiece for the feminist movement now. And it's always a division between the two. So it's just playing out in New York. That's what I saw. A lot of people get into that feminist movement thinking that they're going to be feminists, and they realize that real quick who's really in charge when they get there, who's putting up the money. That clip you played about the publishing, you know, when you look at the banking system worldwide, the United States controls about 45% of it. And the United Kingdom controls about 30% of it through London, but the bulk of it through Jersey, the Cayman Islands, and Hong Kong. But it didn't surprise me that they said in that clip that 75% of the academic journals are written in English worldwide. I mean, that's astounding. And you talk about people who aren't, because in all European countries, they learn English for the most part. But it's, in Latin America, all around the world, in Africa, they don't learn, they're really going to be denied a lot of information. On top of the way they deny it to people by putting it all into their academic system. So I thought that was a very good clip. Mexicans have calves the size of cantaloupes. Man. A measly $6 billion the Democrats allow the government to get shut down. $6 billion, the economy last year hit an all-time high, like $25 trillion on one day, went down the next day. But, they spent over $600 billion a year for military. And he just wants $6 billion, and they're holding it down. The Democrats fought for the reform of welfare in the 90s, cut welfare, didn't fund any of the programs that was part of the cut in the welfare. It was supposed to be programs that compensated for the cuts. Schooling, training, all of those things, didn't fund a bit of it, but they did get their job done to cut in that. They went to the crime bill, funded half of it, built all the prisons, hired more cops, but didn't fund any of the programs that were going to build the community centers, the drug centers, the infrastructure, the parks, the schools. And now they're holding this whole thing up with $6 billion. Like, I tend to think they're the problem. I don't really empathize with the people coming over the border. However, when I heard that story about those four black girls, well, it was more than four, who were kidnapped at a civil rights rally, some as young as 12, some pregnant, held for 3 months without their parents knowing. And I never even heard that story before, but I felt that story. And the first thing I thought is, black people cried over those Mexican kids that was taken away from their parents. But what about this? This has been happening to us for years. Happens to us every day in the foster care system. So, now Laquan McDaniels, the last thing I'm going to say, Gus. 6.5 years out of 96 years for Jason Van Dyke. I say he got off pretty easy. Shot the man 16 times, including shot him several times as he stood over him while he was already dead on the ground. The cops who were let off, that was unacceptable. So the judge, in my opinion, is part of the cover-up because the angles that were missing from the shooting, these same cops went over to the Burger King, took the tape, erased the tape of the shooting, so that would have been the perfect angle of everything. How could they not go to jail just for that? That's obstruction of justice. So, it's no justice in the system for people who are classified as black. And I mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Chicago, Pamela Evans-Harris. Excellent point with the other white comrades, race soldiers, no suspect in terms of them not being. What was the whole point of the body cams? That was what I was thinking with that. What was the whole point? We're just going to have more snuff films of black males, mostly, being shot and killed. And they made a whole podcast. It's called 16 Shots. They don't talk about anything but the Laquan McDonald shooting. 16 Shots. That black misandry, the man not, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood. Exactly what Dr. Curry talked about. Just study, revel, necrophilia, black male death. Not that we're trying to solve this problem. Not that we're even trying to go and get the whites who are responsible for this happening over and over and over. Just we'll revel and talk about it and talk about it and look at all the different angles of the nigger being shot and killed. Any other folks that we have that we missed? Folks who have a hand up that we've not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I was going to speak on the white people that I've listened to on YouTube and other audio and text that I was able to read. The white people talk about, they quote a poem and they say that this is the way the world will end, not with a bang, but with a whisper, or no, with a whimper. The world will end with a, not with a bang, but a whimper. And then I'm translating what they say because I listen to the hours of them speak. And they're saying, basically, there's never going to be justice. White people will never, ever, ever stop white supremacy. They'll actually die first. They'll cease to be white people before they stop white supremacy. That's what they've been saying. And so they never, they're talking about never, ever, ever having justice. And so, okay, so do we have to wait for white people to just cease to exist altogether? Hopefully that's not the case. But white people even give time frames that they say that they will not be white people on the earth. I've heard time frames of 100 years. So that's a long time to have white supremacy. I know that it's possible for there to actually be white people on the earth for 1,000 years or more. You know, it's possible. So it's possible to never, ever end white supremacy. That's what I'm saying. And no, I want justice. I want the end of white supremacy, and I want it now. I want it in my lifetime. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Do you have any updates on the shooter? I believe it was Mr. Bush, the race soldier who did the shooting out in Kentucky. We went to shoot black people, killed two black, didn't just go to shoot. He shot two black people, killed two black people. And attempted to go to the church and shoot some other black people before he did the shooting at the supermarket. Did you have any updates or have you heard any newer information?
I remember that a group of black lawyers were getting together, basically stating some form of injustice. I can't remember the exact thing that I heard on the news, but no, I actually, I'm still a bit terrified about the whole situation, but I will look into it. But no, I haven't heard anything particular about that person who did the shooting. But I mentioned before that I did hear from somebody who spoke with me that the person was, I don't know if this is true, but I was told that the person who did the shooting, that white male, was dropped off by another individual in a car. And so he was with another individual, and that there was actually video footage of it from somebody's device. So I've heard that. I don't know what's true, what's not, but I will look into that.
spectacular. This was at a supermarket, so they generally have lots and lots of surveillance cameras at supermarkets out in the parking lot and all that. Everybody is, you know, crashing their carts into everyone's vehicle and looting over the latest gift and what have you. So there should be ample video footage if that is the case. But system of white supremacy. Other folks that we have missed completely, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you at all, you should speak now. Make sure I give out the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks that we've not heard from at all.
Have you heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to us, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with the, I think that was the, is his name Steve King? Is that what his name is, Gus?
The congressman in Iowa who is defending the terms white nationalism and white supremacy?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think I remember seeing a, it was a news segment, and I think he did use that term, I guess, Western civilization. That may be the same person. He was on a panel. Maybe it was CNN. And people were, I guess, or the other panelists were, I guess, I'm going to say shocked, but they didn't expect him, I guess, to use that term. But that's interesting that from the context that I heard of it, he was saying, well, you know, I was really, I guess, supporting the terms. I was just trying to say it the way that I said it. I guess something of a fucking nature or whatever. But the women, like the support, the white women, the white female support of that type of mindset, that kind of behavior, racist behavior, I wanted to also keep that in mind because when, and I'm glad that you played that segment where Donald Trump was asked that question about the type of tweets, the high frequency of tweets that he put out on social media. And I'm quite sure Obama would be labeled as lazy, porch monkey or whatever, you know, the racist terms, if he were to do the same thing. But the gigantic response that was in that audience, that may have been Megyn Kelly, I think that's who that was, that asked him that. He didn't even, he said just Rosie O'Donnell, a white woman. And, you know, hey, that's, you call women pigs and this and that. That was major support, and I guarantee you that audience, that collective audience, had to be white. Okay, so that's that codification. But it's supposed to be about, you know, we got to put these men in jail. And the caller, a few callers back mentioning the Gillette commercial. But it's just, once again, the hypocrisy, the racist hypocrisy that's present. With the, I think, the Women's March, there was a black female that went on to the, I think, the show called The View. I think she's responsible. I wouldn't say responsible, but she's, I think, in a high position of being the inventor of, I guess, an organization, a women's organization. Her and another non-white female had to pretty much, well, not oppose, but give some counter, in my opinion, counter-racist language and responses to a racist, hostile white woman on that panel. I think it's Meghan McCain. And I noticed it was a part of the interview where they brought up Minister Farrakhan, and she was saying, hey, you know, are you going to denounce, or are you going to, I don't know, disassociate. I can't remember what that word it was. And she just kept giving the same response. I don't agree with some of the things or something that she kept saying, and she asked it like four times. So, you know, I like that codification, definite confidence having confidence in yourself. That was a very, very good segment that I wanted to point out. And I know that they're going to mention, I'm hearing that they mentioned Michael Jackson, that they're going to do a documentary on that. But once again, like, if anybody remembers that, To Catch a Predator, that TV show, and you remember all of the people they were catching, who were the majority of the, I guess, they may say suspected predators, but really they were in the act, the depraved act of doing that to a child. And that's all I have right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. Caller in Florida. I saw the Gillette commercial and I gave it a thumbs down this week. I saw several reports where they said that commercial got a lot of, I guess, bad feedback, where people commented that they didn't like it and they felt it was, heard that a lot of white men in particular, they thought this was a part of the what they call war on white men, white masculinity. Henry Macko, he's been a guest on the program. He writes about that sort of thing, repeated guest on the program. But I disliked it. It was exactly what Dr. Curry talked about. They showed, and they might have different versions of it, but the one that I saw, they had young children, boys, fighting. One time it was a black boy was one of the ones fighting. And then they had a line of dads, including a black male. And they made sure that when they zoomed in, because it was a long row of dads saying, boys will be boys, that the frame where they zoomed in, black male smiling, boys will be boys. Exactly what Dr. Curry said. If we have a so-called system of patriarchy, if, I'm not in agreement there, but if we do, black males are not patriarchs. If you want to make that commercial, fine. Put all white people in it. I don't want to hear anything about R. Kelly or anything else. If there's so-called patriarchy, line up a whole bunch of white men and there you go. I'd let them brawl and fight and do whatever you want. But once you start putting black males in there, I'm good. This is an act of racism, white supremacy, and thumbs down from Gus T. Renegade. And from what I saw on YouTube, there were way more thumbs down than thumbs up for this commercial. Reminded me of the Cheerios commercial they had where they were supposed to be promoting tragic arrangements. I gave that one a thumbs down, too. A lot of white people didn't like that ad either. Any other folks that we missed completely?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chris. This is a victim in Austin at the plantation, as always. Just wanted to say hello and hope everyone is doing well under the circumstances that we are in. I just wanted to make a quick statement on the one of the commenters. She talked about that phrase from the black historian. I can't remember his name, but he talked about white people being greatly pained about racism, but not pained enough or whatnot. And for him to even comment that they're greatly pained, I think that that's, you know, VGQ, of course, for him. But I disagree with the statement. And I kind of see that in the wall funding. They had that GoFundMe for the Build a Wall. And they managed to raise like $20 million in a couple of weeks. And I just thought, wow, they were able to, I know you say you don't like metaphors and things like that, but, you know, form Voltron to, you know, get together $20 million for this wall. But there was a broadcast he did some years ago with suspected white supremacist in this Hulu movement, I think. And I think you had asked them about how much money they managed to raise for, you know, black empowerment or black liberation or whatnot. And I think he said something around the amount of $2,000 or something that was just completely minuscule and just totally just insane number. And like I said, when these folks want to get something done, they're going to get it done. They're going to work together to get it done no matter what. So I think, you know, again, the greatly pained is a lie. They're not more good, i.e. good white folks, than there are bad ones. That's a lie. You know, these people don't believe in justice. They don't believe in doing what is just at all. That's really all that I have for now. I can't really speak that long, but thanks again for taking my call. I appreciate it. I'll go ahead and mute myself now.
Yes, ma'am. Have fun if you go to the South by Southwest Festival that's coming up in your part of the plantation. That was last year, too. Thomas in New York was talking about Texas, the bombings in Austin, where they were bombing and killing black males were the only two fatalities, if my memory is correct. That was from the beginning of last year. GTT gone to Texas. That was the infamous, the half has never been told, Edward Baptist. Maybe that book should be in the top 10 as well, because that book gets referenced all the time. And that was another difficult book to read. I won't make a comparison now, but that was a challenging book to read. Not easy at all, but it gets referenced all the time. We read that, I think that was 2015. I think that was 2015. Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, in the book club. Reading is more important than watching television. Anybody that we missed completely? Anybody have a hand up that we have not heard from at all? We got everybody? Spectacular. Princess, did you want to share? You said you had additional comments. Did you want to share your additional thoughts?
Yes, I was also going to say it's been reported the word, there's been a lot of talk around the word toxic masculinity. I would also note that that's one of those words I have deemed that is. To me, for the feminists, it's kind of like scapegoating black males to throw off responsibility from what I see a lot of black females continue to participate in, just the lack of accountability for their role and their part in playing against a lot of the stuff that tends to go on and feed this narrative and attack against black males. And I think that's it for now.
Much obliged. They got whole television shows about toxic black masculinity. Let's see. Other folks have commentary that we
can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
So upon thinking a little more, I remember, I believe the lawyers, the black lawyers that there was a news story on, as far as the black lawyers were upset, or they were going to have some legal situation or proceeding based on the shooting not being reported as a hate, what is it called? A hate crime. That the white people on the news were going out of their way to, like I mentioned before, not say the race of the person, any of the individuals. And even once it was revealed what the race of the people, the shooter and the black people who got killed, the white people were going out of their way to not say that this was a hate crime. They kept talking about mental illness. And then the other thing, did you hear that in the news recently, the birth rate for America, so white people in America, has recently, I think all the states are below replacement rate. Just wonder if you heard that. And also, that doesn't necessarily mean that white supremacy is about to end.
Absolutely. You can say that 8-12 times. No, I had not heard that, that it was below replacement rate in all of the states. But again, that does not mean the system of white supremacy is about to end. Did other folks have commentary they needed to make sure they get in?
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call again. I have a question about the person who's coming. I was yesterday, no, Thursday, was in the book. You said Monday, and then today you said Tuesday. Which day?
Tuesday.
Is she coming? Tuesday, definitely Tuesday.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Made an error. Okay. The other day when I said Monday. It is definitely Tuesday.
Oh, I understand. You're doing a lot. No problem. Just wanted to be clear.
Yes, ma'am.
No problem. No problem about all that. And I guess on the side note, the Australian Open is going on. I know that's not important, but Serena Williams has won so far, and she's consoling all her little people that she just, not beat up, but, she scores very well on. She's beating them, what they would say, in a handily fashion. Looks very easy on TV. Like, she's on her way. The white superstar, Maria Sharapova, she beat a young lady very badly. She said, I don't have time for empathy. The other lady started crying. I don't have time for empathy. She's in the Grand Slam. Get it together. If it was the other way around, I'm sure there would be major outbreak. How could Serena talk like this? Blah, blah, blah. This, that, and the other. So, just wanted to bring that up. That is, she seems to do all she can. When she has an outburst, she's drawn like an ape. This, that, and the other. This other young lady has been proven to use illegal substance. And she doesn't have to have any compassion like anybody. She could just be tall, white, blonde, and keep it moving.
Keep it moving. Maria Sharapova, in addition to using drugs, where she, I believe, was suspended for a year for testing positive.
Yeah.
And Serena Williams, they were testing her every other hour. I've never heard of her testing positive for any banned substances. I have heard about her being tested more than any other athlete. And Maria Sharapova makes substantially more money than Serena Williams. Like, not a little bit, like substantially more.
And
money.
All that is outside of tennis, because inside of tennis, Serena definitely makes more money because she wins more. So that is outside of tennis.
Which is even more astounding. I'll leave it there. The white person with a record of drug abuse and less accomplished as a player still makes more money than Serena Williams, who has to fight off being compared to a gorilla or a male or both. Other folks, do you have commentary you want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. About Serena, another book, Richard Williams' book, Black and White. This man dressed up like a Klansman and went and beat up white people at night, and his daughters are both in these tragic arrangements. It's just the irony. The birth rate that Imhan Deci just brought up, what shocks me more than anything was that I read a lot that China is below the point where they can even repopulate themselves. Even with their 1.5 billion population, they killed off so many of the women, where the few women they have, they don't want to have children. They want to go and live a life. They want to go be free. And it's just very interesting that it seems like all of Europe has a lower birth rate. All of Asia, even India, lower in birth rate. In the Arab world, lower in birth rate. They blame the wars. And the only place where it seems like all the birth rates are going up is Africa, and in what they call Latin and South and Central America. Very interesting. And as far as putting an end to white supremacy, see, the white people are setting up a system so that white supremacy will be around even when their numbers are so low they can't enforce it with the technology. If you look at a lot of the technology they're bringing out to make the decisions, it's being programmed by white people. It has a white mindset, and it has the function now programmed into it to maintain the status quo as it is now. So, you know, definitely have to do something about these people. And I'll mute my lines. That's a great show.
Context of white supremacy. We have about 5 minutes, a little less than 5 minutes left in the broadcast. If folks have any final thoughts, questions, suggestions they would like to make sure they share before we wrap up. Again, reading more important than watching television. Dr. Welsing, I'm sure, would concur. Any other thoughts folks wanted to share? Everybody got in their comment, suggestions.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I was just thinking of it was a segment where I think they were talking about using the term racist, and that I think that was a victim, and I know it's VGQ, but I think the comment was, well, did the guy see Steve King's comments as racist? I think that's what the question was, and I believe he said that it didn't warrant the response that it got. Was that the comment that he made, Gus?
Yes, sir. He said he didn't. It was something to the effect, very close to that phrasing. It didn't warrant the response that it got, and it was definitely racist. What Steve King said was definitely racist.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, I was like, wow, white people are definitely very skilled with how they could put a non-white person in that kind of position to get them to explain. But you all are the experts. And I know I've spoken about Skip Bayless on ESPN like that. He tends to be a repetitive person who does that. So that's the only thing I have. And thank you.
Excellent. Excellent point. Said that as well. White people, and they have a pattern. I think they'll do that on the Young Turks. Sometime they'll bring a black person on and then ask the black person, do you think that such and such is racist, or what this white person is accused of doing or did do is racist? The experts are whites. And again, it's their opinion that matters in terms of doing something, if somebody is going to be punished for their racist conduct. And Skip Bayless, I cannot say. Yes, ma'am, Irie.
I apologize. You want to finish your statement?
No, ma'am. Proceed.
Oh, really quick. I'm starting to believe from this evening's segment that when white people ask non-white black people what they think about a situation, if it's racist or not, it may be a case of racial showcasing confusion to take the responsibility of identifying the racism within themselves off of them and putting it onto us. And they're already going to suspect or expect us to say, well, of course they're going to say it's racism. You know, they're black, you know. And also make themselves look as though they are not racist because they are considering, and I say that in italics, what we think, if that makes sense. Well, I if that situation is racist, well, then I'm definitely not racist because I'm asking you, you know. So that's it. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged. 30 seconds. Anybody need a final comment? We're all satisfied? Grand. We will be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. And we should also be here Tuesday. It is irregular time 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Central, 11 a.m. Pacific, Tuesday, for Ann Michelson. She's live from Norway to discuss the new American classic, The Hate U Give, allegedly written by a black female author, allegedly. Also in the book club, quite a few of them, Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It, also in the book club, as previously mentioned. Reading is more important than watching television. Quite a few texts in the book club archives that you can go through and read, and or you could just pick out the books and read them yourself. With that, we will call it a broadcast. Thanks for all the folks who tuned in. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. I will suggest again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's do all that we can to remain sober under conditions of war being waged against us, especially black people. In addition to being sober, if we're going to be in a vehicle, let's be buckled up each and every time, that's driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Oh, and I will say, just because I do know black parents, prenatal yoga instructor, I cannot believe it's 2019. Anyone tells you quit your job, this is directed to females, of course. Anyone says, you know, quit your job, I got it, I will take care of you. I cannot believe that that still works in 2019. Like, that is absolute folly for anyone to think that way, to believe that way. You can end up in some very difficult positions. That is not advice that you want to follow. Do not believe that. And even if it is true, you do not want to be in that predicament. Someone telling you, oh yeah, just quit your job, I got it. Danger. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of racism, white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.